Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, February 11th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Heather Digby Parton, from the blog Hullabaloo, and of course her column at salon.com. Also joining us later in the program, Matthew Film Guy, to completely ignore the Oscar nominations. Meanwhile, two senators issue an urgent warning. The CIA has gone rogue with its bulk data collection program. Meanwhile, Donald Trump illegally took classified documents to Mar-a-Lago when he wasn't flushing them down the toilet.
Doing some homework.
Doing my reading by the pool. Not with my shirt on, though.
Dems pushing Biden to hurry up on picking a SCOTUS nominee.
Be quick.
Biden splits the Afghan frozen assets, half to humanitarian aid, half to 9/11 victims funds. And in an act of unmitigated cowardice, the White House puts the kibosh on safe drug smoking kits. Progressive push have created imminent stock trading ban vote, at least for lawmakers. Russia increases its forces and grows its threat of a Ukraine invasion. 3,000 workers in New York City face a vax deadline today. Meanwhile, across the country, infections, hospitalizations down, still 2,400 people a day dying. And U.S. asked Canadian authorities to use their federal authority to end the right-wing anti-vax blockade on one-third of the goods that trade between Canada and the U.S. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. It is Casual Friday, as noted by our Casual Friday intro.
Whoa.
Yes. Emma was very on top of that. Emma Vigeland is here. The anticipation is palpable. She is collecting quarters from every, she was ruffling through the couch, cushions in the couch, I should say, looking around. Do you need this anymore? Can I put it on eBay? Mm-hmm. Just getting all the cash ready for the massive betting at a spree that you're going to go on with the Super Bowl on Sunday.
Where's your wallet?
Exactly. That is a good question, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
You might guys waiting outside that look suspiciously like bookies, too.
Right.
So.
Well,
and the thing
even
is,
though it's legal in New York now, somehow I still have some outstanding debts.
It's possible. Okay. It wouldn't surprise me. We should say, you know, Emma's not just, you're not just betting on the outcome of the game. Mm-hmm. You're betting on like 20 other potential like areas of betting, right?
Right.
Like,
I have props, but I mean, I just want to make the audience know, like, I bet $20 bets, $20 to $30, and then occasionally I'll do $50 if I feel really confident, like I just decided who I think is going to win on Sunday.
Yeah, tell it to the judge.
There was a program called Happy Days when I grew up, where mm-hmm. which was about this guy Richie Cunningham and the Fonz.
I'm aware of the Fonz.
Okay.
think we know.
Well, sort of aware.
Sort of.
Fonz is a timeless archetype.
Yes.
Right.
And there was one scene where Richie Cunningham got really drunk for the first time. And his dad was like, how much did you have to drink? And he just said, like, a tiny, tiny glass like this. And his father was like, how many did you have of those? 32.
Right.
That's what, when you said, like, I only make small $20 bets. Mm-hmm. Yes, but you make hundreds of those bets in a game.
Not true.
Based upon on the fourth down in the, you know, how many fourth down conversions will be in the first half,
and how fast and then, will the wind be blowing?
What will be the wind? Who wins the coin toss? And
how
and
will then, the balls be inflated in terms of the air pressure? Right.
You're betting on every. Literally, like, attendance numbers, how many times, you know, how many times someone's going to, like, flex their legs if they score a touchdown.
Flex their legs?
You know, squeeze their knees together, like,
what?
In a...
What, they have to poop, or what are you talking about?
No, like, the dance or something, like, yeah. You know, in the celebration in the end zone.
Right, they squeeze their knees together.
Listen, I don't know. I mean, maybe the answer is none, and that's how you win your... small, tiny bet.
So this is not accurate, but that's fine. I'll just let you go with the bit. That is not what I do,
okay.
But that's okay. There are real degenerates who like gamble on if the next pitch is going to be a strike or a ball. That's
right.
Offered. I don't do things. It's very not. Whatever. I don't know. As I'm digging. The more I deny it, the more it sounds bad.
I mean, it does.
Yeah,
there's a lot of protesting going on.
Can't win.
We've been following this story for at least over the course of the past week, maybe longer than that. And again, want to reiterate, absolutely the right thing to do to end our occupation of Afghanistan after 20 years. Absolutely the wrong thing to do to leave the country... as if we had nothing to do with the situation they're in, as if we had no moral responsibility to the Afghan people, regardless of who their leaders are, regardless of you know, how their leaders came to power. When we evacuated from Afghanistan, there was $7 billion worth of Afghan assets in essentially what amounts to bank accounts in this country. Of course, the Afghan officials all left. There was some question as to, like, who had access even to these funds. You know, like, who had the login information? That may be a little bit of a... but it's more or less like
sort
that.
Of.
And
but this is the Afghan government's funds.
Exactly. And the Taliban, when they gained control of Afghanistan, said that's our money. And presumably, I would not imagine that the Taliban is going to use that money in the way that I would want to use that money. But some of that money would have to go to the Afghan people. Because surely there is some political pressure on the Taliban by not providing these funds and to operating their civil society in a way that they wouldn't get political pressure from their people. Otherwise, why would we do it in the first place?
Well, there is a massive currency crisis happening now in Afghanistan, and the fact that we're depriving the government of these funds means that the currency is not getting to the people. I have no doubt that the Taliban is going to shave off some for themselves, but the point is that it's a famine in Afghanistan right now.
And so there was political pressure starting to build on Biden in this country to resolve what to do with those funds. In fact, there are some people who believe that you should actually give humanitarian aid on top of those funds. President Biden, in a real show of political courage, I say that facetiously, will essentially allow some relatives of victims of the 9/11 attacks to pursue half of those funds, $3.5 billion, in lawsuits. Apparently, over the course of the past 20 years, we couldn't figure out where to get $3.5 billion when we're spending God knows how many. I think that was probably our monthly budget for a long time in Afghanistan.
Yeah, so this is presumably done for the propaganda value of doing something for the 9/11 victims,
yes,
right? But really, it just points a finger at how little we've been doing for those folks.
I mean, it, the idea that you're going to make the Afghan people pay 20-some-odd years later when they're in this situation. And again, we played that clip from Rand Paul the other day. It was like, we've put so much money into that country, it's hard to imagine that they don't owe us much more than $7 billion, which is just an astonishing thing to say if you are, I don't know, it would be an astonishing thing to say if you had only spent like a week from not living under a rock over the course of the past 20 years, as opposed to like being a senator.
Let alone, are we freezing Saudi Arabia's
assets? Yeah, of course. The hypocrisy is
or the idea that the Afghan government bears like a special responsibility for 9/11. It's, I mean, in this current climate, it's ridiculous. More than our own government.
At the end of the day, it's like, okay, if you want to give that $3.5 billion to a trust fund to pay for, some type of trust fund or escrow account that people could sue, fine. Then just give another $3.5 billion of aid to the Taliban. Of course, he's not going to do that. The other $3.5 billion will go into a trust fund to pay for humanitarian relief efforts. It's unclear what the processes will be for that.
But that's part of the issue, too. The humanitarian, like being gatekeepers and picking and choosing how we're going to spend this. The issue is, as experts keep saying, the currency crisis. The only solution to this is to get currency and funds to the Afghan government. We left Afghanistan. We understood that the Taliban was going to take over. And now we're going to deprive them of the money that is being held overseas. Like, people don't even realize the Afghanistan's gross domestic product is $20 billion. This amount of money would really alleviate a lot of suffering that's happening right now.
And when you say about the currency crisis, the problem is that their central bank needs to have a certain amount of capital reserves in their bank, and they don't have it because they don't have access to this money. So it owes money to commercial banks, and without being able to maintain these reserves, the commercial banks don't get their money, and that means that Afghan citizens do not get their money. This is, it's a mess. It's completely indicative of a problem that the Biden administration has, it seems to me, which is just a complete fear of what is going to be on Fox News tomorrow. We will talk more about that with Heather Parton Digby, because we have seen this. We've seen this movie. Well, it's not a movie, but we've seen this story in the past. We'll talk more about that in a moment. Meantime, word from our sponsor. It is Friday. You know what that means? Today's sponsor, Sunset Lake Sebadeh.
I had another wonderful night's sleep with the biggest tincture last night, because I had to get up early this morning, and it really, really did the trick.
It's been huge for me. Huge. And Sunset Lake Sebadeh, use the code Left is Best. You get 20% off. What do you get 20% off? Well, some of the best Sebadeh products you can find anywhere. Anywhere. They have tinctures, as Emma just alluded to. They have new, stronger, more concentrated tinctures. They have flavored tinctures. They have smokables. They have pre-rolls and kief and flowers, and they have multiple different types. They have gummy bears. They have fudge that has Sebadeh in it. They have coffee with Sebadeh. They have lotion, hemp lotion. They have a salve with arnica. And all of these Zebedé products have a incredibly thorough breakdown of all of their components, the percentages of the various different types of Zebedé, Zebedé A, Zebedé G, everything that's in these products is on their website, tested by third party. Same with all the batches and whatnot. They go through a very rigorous process. Their farming practices are great. They practice regenerative farming with help from the University of Vermont, which apparently is got a great agricultural problem. Program. They have great business practices. $15 minimum wage, mostly employee-owned company, and they've been real movement partners, donated thousands of dollars to both charities and things like the Nurses Union in Worcester. We've got to get an update on that, too, actually, because there's a movement by the SCABs to try and decertify that union there. But just a great all-around company and a great all-around product. Check it out, sunsetlakezebedé.com. I know I say those three letters, Charlie Baker Delta, in a funny way, but that's because of, you know, we're not, YouTube
gets
a little,
censored.
We're getting censored. Left is best. Left is best gives you 20% off. Check it out. Great company, great product. You will not be disappointed. All right. Want to welcome back to the program. Matt, you want to get in? Wait, what? Hold on.
Hello.
We're getting a little bit of feedback. Before we do that, we have this. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is Heather Partner Digby from the blog Digby. Heather, we're getting some weird feedback on that. Are you guys hearing that?
Yeah.
Heather.
Let me try something here.
All right.
Yeah, a little bit too loud, and we're picking up something else weird.
Still?
I think we're better now. And if you could just turn your volume, your input volume down, that would be good too.
That's what I just did, so hopefully that helps. No?
Yeah, a little bit more. I'll tell you what, let's take a quick break and while we work on this.
Sorry, guys.
We are back, ladies and gentlemen. We have dealt with our technical difficulties. Heather Parton, the proprietor of the Uber blog Hullabaloo, and also columnist at Salon.com. Heather, welcome. We're here with Emma Vigeland.
Oh, thanks for having me. Hi, Emma.
Hi. Hi, Heather.
So there was a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about, Heather. We will talk. Let's talk about the Republicans. There is a interesting dynamic this week that you wrote about, actually. Republicans wanting it sort of, well, I don't know if they want it both ways, or I can't quite figure out it. But let's just also start with the Biden administration. There's been two things over the past couple of days that really are indicative of a dynamic that I know you're familiar with. We went through this with the Obama administration from almost day one, it felt like. And it is it is enraging. It's nuts. And that is between both this sort of rescission of the grant money for safe drug pipe smoking that they have now pulled, and this splitting of the Afghan assets so that, you know, depriving the Taliban presumably of billions of dollars, and switching the $3.5 billion to humanitarian aid when the Central Bank of Afghanistan needs this money. They are just in this like incredibly defensive crouch that it's almost as like there's something, you know, they found the Manny Codex, and they're just reading off the game plan that has been eternal with Democratic administrations.
It is so predictable, and, you know, and it's all, I mean, all of this is coming purely from what they perceive as blowback from the right wing and the Republican and, you know, conservative media that has pushed on the Afghanistan issue. It's that, you know, Biden mishandled the leaving from Afghanistan. And this thing with the crack pipes is just, you know, it's Shirley Sherrod, it's Acorn, it's, you know, yeah, it's General Petraeus. It's, I mean, I used to call this thing, I used to call it a patented hissy fit. And they go through this thing and they have this big explosion, and immediately the Democrats back off, immediately showing weakness and basically, you know, admitting that something is wrong with the decision that they made. I wish I understood this. I mean, you would think after all these years, and this goes all the way back to Clinton, maybe even Carter. It's possible it goes back that far. It certainly goes back to Clinton and also Obama, which is this, you know, this instant, you know, terror that they feel that they're being, you know, and they feel that the polling is bad and they've got to do this stuff. I mean, I'm waiting for the next couple of weeks. They're going to start firing people, right? I mean, this is the next step. They're going to let, you know, somebody go and some sacrificial lamb, and somebody else is going to be taken to the woodshed and God only knows what. This is such a predictable dynamic. And it's so pathetic because at this point, you know, look at what we're dealing with on the other side. I mean, they're out there saying that the insurrection was, you know, what did they call it?
Legitimate political discourse.
So, you know, I mean, it's absolutely absurd. Yes, the polling numbers are low, but it's not because of crack pipes. It's because of inflation and the pandemic. And, you know, and these are big, huge structural problems. And the fact that they're running from these little things just tells you the weakness. And it makes me sad because they actually do have an opportunity, because the right wing is in such disarray and they're fighting amongst themselves, which we can talk about. They actually probably, there's a chance they could salvage this Congress in the fall if they played their cards right. But I don't see any evidence that they're going to do that.
I see a tiny, tiny speck of evidence, but let's wait on that, because there was a tweet I saw today. It's not directly on point, but it was from somebody from, I think, from Pew. And they were doing polling about in January. 23% of the public said they had heard a lot about Russia's military buildup near Ukraine. 15% heard a lot about recent cases before the Supreme Court. That would be, incidentally, well, I don't know if this would have counted for in January, you know, the Alabama one, but I mean, certainly other cases in terms involving abortion. I mean, presumably, right? People would have heard about that. 9% heard a lot about U.S. diplomatic boycott of Beijing Olympics. The point being is that the percentage of people who heard about the pipes, you know, it has to be so infinitesimally small. The number of people who would have an issue with the, and I know exactly how it go. You're giving the Taliban $7 billion as if it's like our, you know, money. Like, let's just go back to like the billions of dollars that they said that they gave Iran, which was also, again, not true. It was just that we had frozen Iranian assets.
Right.
This stuff has no political salience. And it is the functional equivalent, and I have no doubt they can make it as big as they did, of the Dr. Seuss, you know, books being pulled. Does everybody remember that? Like
Mr. Potato Head.
The way that they respond to these things is just stunning. It is just stunning. Like what? Like they are living in a universe where A, they don't understand the media environment anymore at all. I don't think they have any concept of the media environment. And they also don't have a concept of this is stuff like, I'm trying to come up with some type of like analogy, or it's like if you have dogs and cats and like somehow you leave like the toy the cats are playing with has any bearing on what the dog does. The dog doesn't care at all what the cats are playing with. Like every conservative in the country could know about the crack pipes. The clean crack, and it's not going to change a single vote come the fall at all, at all.
Exactly. Those people are not, you know, they are gone. They are the people who are watching Fox News, Newsmax, and OAN. I mean, look at the numbers. I mean, just in sheer numbers, what is it? Maybe 3 million people a night? This is a country of 350 million people. So 3 million people are watching Fox News. Maybe there's a few million more who catch up on the news online or watch on Facebook or whatever. This is not that those people who care about crack pipes are gone. They are not ever going to vote for Democrats. Nobody else knows about the crack pipes, or more importantly, none of them care about the crack pipes. This is not an issue that people are sitting around going, wow, that Biden administration, they're just, you know, they're really pushing drug use or something. I mean, it's like out of, it is Mr. Potato Head and Dr. Seuss. You're absolutely right. It's the same thing. And it would be as if, you know, Joe Biden came out and gave a big speech about Dr. Seuss and how much he really wanted those books back. You know, and said it's really important that we have every Dr. Seuss book in the libraries or whatever. I mean, this is ridiculous. And of course, I mean, there are some issues that seem to be salient that are being pushed on the right, like, you know, the critical race theory thing and anti-masking and that kind of stuff in the school boards and all that. That's legitimate concern for people working on congressional races. They have to think about that stuff because it does have salience, you know, among voters who are not just Fox viewers, apparently, from what the polling says. So they have to think about that stuff. But this idea of, you know, but getting back to Afghanistan, which is really, really important. Nobody cares about that, about the fact that, you know, they're giving humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. And if anything, all the people who were just crying crocodile tears over our abandonment of the Afghan people and how we'd been there for years and then we just left them behind and blah, blah, blah. And they're still going on and on about the terrible evacuation. These are the same people who they're afraid of. They're afraid of those people saying you're giving money to the Afghan, to the Taliban, just like you gave to the Iranians, as you point out, which, I mean, those are the same people. So none of this makes any sense. And I think you and I've talked about this before. When you're in these situations, like with the Afghan situation, this is a humanitarian catastrophe that is happening in Afghanistan. People are starving. There's pictures that looks like, you know, Ethiopia back in the 80s. I mean, there's little pictures of little children starving, that this money is sitting there, that in this kind of situation, you just do the right thing. You don't, you know, the politics are going to be what they are. And, you know, they'll probably be bad. I don't even know. And that shouldn't even be a consideration. We've been in this place many times before. And the idea that, I mean, I thought Joe Biden was Mr. I got a big heart and I care about people. You know, I mean, that was his main attraction, I think, was that he's, you know, the kind of, you know, griever in chief and that sort of thing. So I'm very disappointed, to be honest with you. That is something that is really, really disappointing me. The lack of compassion for the Afghan people.
Oh, well, that has been just atrocious. I mean, and it's frankly, I mean,
it's awful.
We have had that. That has been the case for 21 years, and then frankly, the same with the Iraqi people and the Yemeni people. I mean, that's how we roll in this country. Yes, from a humanitarian standpoint, this is they should have never. This issue should have been resolved 4 months ago. They should have just done it so they didn't have time to sit there and become a political question. But I want people to understand this, like that distinction with the CRT and the school boards. And I think a lot of that is contingent, frankly, on where COVID is come the fall. But this is the way the dynamic works. And I know you know this, Heather, but I just want to make this clear to everybody. Joe Biden theoretically has a legislative agenda. It is now, let's just pretend that he has a legislative agenda that remains. I am a congressperson from some district in Pennsylvania that is, you know, purplish. If I vote with the president and he's got big poll ratings, and this may or may not be the case, but it's certainly what the White House presumes these lawmakers are thinking. And it is, in many ways, the way the lawmakers think. Whether it's right or wrong, that's the way they think. So the White House feels like, oh, we need to have good poll numbers to convince these lawmakers to vote with us. Now, we have seen that didn't work with Joe Manchin, although he was able to wait until he was able to sink Joe Biden's. I'm quite convinced that the sinkage started happening when he invited Republicans into the White House to talk about Build Back Better. But nevertheless, the idea that Joe Biden has any type of legislative agenda that's going to be controversial enough at this point that it's going to make a difference to that blue state voter or that purple lawmaker, you know, this issue of the crack pipes. But they don't have to address that. That lawmaker may have to address CRT or school boards and finesse it in some way and come up with an answer, maybe by the fall. But they'll never have to address the crack pipes. Mm-hmm. That's never going to be something that's come up. Now, I said earlier there is a tiny speck of something that leads me to believe I don't know how it's going to go in the House. Really, we were talking about the Senate. You know, can we hold the Senate? The House is not as bad as I think people make it out to be at this point. But you know, we've got a long time. But this ban on stock trading, this is one that I think is going to be. And Ryan Grimm's done some reporting in The Intercept that shows, you know, that there were some like legislative machinations by the members of the squad who really forced this to the fore. Now, it's not just the squad, to be fair, that is pushing this. Even Abigail Spanberger, Spanberger, she's for it. And again, which I think sort of enhances the thesis that we have all talked about here, that it's the younger generation that understands politics better than the older generation at this point, because she realizes like this is a good issue.
Yeah,
corruption is a great issue. People love to talk about the corruption of other people. And so despite the fact that Nancy Pelosi did not want this ban, despite the fact that she went out and defended the practice of, like, not even it almost extolled the practice of lawmakers trading stocks.
Patriotic American.
She said it's the free market. Like, first off, she also doesn't seem to know what the free market means, but nevertheless, she extolled it, and she was sort of bullied into this, and she was bullied into this because of the nature of the bill.
Yeah.
This is something that if I am a Democratic challenger to a Republican candidate running for re-election in my district, I am praying they vote against this. Mm-hmm. I am praying they vote against
it. And just to add to your point about it being the younger generation as well, John Ossoff was another person who has pushed these kinds of issues. He introduced the ban on corporate PACs in the Senate as well. And when he was running, even though he's a moderate Democrat, there is an understanding that this galvanizes people. And the old leadership who, you know, let's be real, Nancy Pelosi is one of the top beneficiaries of the fact that we don't have a stock trading ban for members of Congress. They're unwilling to let go in many ways, but it's so apparent with this.
I, you know, pe- people, and Heather, back me up on this or not, but one of the sort of submerged memories of 2006, it wasn't just the war. In fact, I'm not even convinced it was the war that won the Congress for the Democrats in 2006. It was the fact that a soon-to-be-revealed pedophile was covering up for a sexual predator in Mark Foley. And it was all of that dynamic, the underlying corruption narrative that was there that got the Democrats the House in 2006. And this stock ban thing, like the idea that there was a moment hesitation by anybody other than they wanted to enrich themselves, obviously, is shocking. But it's the younger generation of Dems who got out in front of this.
I still even find it. I mean, 2006, the slogan that the Democrats ran on, they ran against the culture of corruption. It was, and it wasn't, you know, there was Mark Foley, there was Jack Abramoff, remember
yep.
that whole scandal?
Yep.
I mean, there was one scandal after another and all these financial scandals that were going on in the Bush administration. And they, that's how they won, was on that. And so Nancy Pelosi comes out. I mean, I have to tell you, I really was shocked by that. Not because I didn't know that she's, you know, vastly wealthy and that she might be protecting the people who want to do that. I mean, I'm not that naive. It's just so politically stupid to come out and say it like as she did. No, you know, she came out and just very robustly defended the idea that people, members of Congress, should have the right to trade stocks. And I don't think there was anybody in the country, even the people who were upset about crack pipes, probably sat there and went, what?
You know? Oh, definitely.
You know? Right. I mean, what are you talking about? I mean, nobody. And in fact, I think for a lot of Americans, they're shocked to find out that there isn't a ban on trading stocks among members of Congress. How can that be? They all have obvious insider information all the time on all kinds of things. They're working on things. They have all these big donors who are, you know, whispering in their ears. I mean, the whole thing, it just doesn't even make any sense, you know. And I wanted to give a little shout out too to Katie Porter, who's another one who's been pushing this. She's not a member mm-hmm. of the squad, but definitely on this financial corruption beat in the Congress. And, you know, she was sitting there saying, she says, I don't think people can believe that this has been going on this long. And I don't think that they can. There's a little bit of a bright spot and potentially something that Democrats, if they're smart enough, and maybe the fact that Abigail Spanberger, of all people, sees that as a good talking point for her, because she's very conservative, and she's in a very tight race. I mean, this is going to be a tight one. If she thinks that is going to be a selling point, they should listen to that, because and all of them should get behind it. But I don't know, you know, and that's not the only thing. There are plenty of the, you know, corruption agenda that they could be doing. In fact, didn't we assume, I kind of thought when the Democrats took over in 2021, that the corruption agenda was going to be big, right?
That was HR1, right? That was a big part of that. And they sort of have lost their way. But also, do people forget that, like, was it like sort of like Kelly Loeffler? Did she partially lose her race as a function of having stock trading at that time, right? Or I mean, was it maybe that came out after?
No, it was the high. That's why Ossoff was like highlighting that, and that's why he's doubling down that he's now that he's won.
And Burr is resigning, and now I don't know if the reason why, but he was caught up in that. Maybe she's doing this as like some type of sop to Dianne Feinstein. I don't know.
What about drain the swamp?
But
like, what about that? That was a way to appeal to this entire this very sensibility. Sorry,
but this is all, I think, like an indication of, you know, when we sit here and we talk about how politically sort of deaf the leadership of the Democratic Party is. Now, maybe it's deaf because they have money stuffed in their ears. And honestly, like literally, it could just, I don't understand the concept of having the kind of money Nancy Pelosi has and being her age and saying, like, I've got to allow stock trading for the next 2 years that I am in Congress. Like, I, and it could be just ideologically, she's just surrounded by these people. Maybe she thinks, like, there are two or three key votes I need if I want to retain power, you know, as a leader. I don't know. But this is not, like, this is just bad politics. And the younger generation understands it. Like, again, you say Ossoff, you say, like, all these people, Spanberger, these are not people who I, you know, am ideologically in love with. Ossoff, I think, has been far better, at least in the context of, you know, what we've had to deal with than one might have anticipated. But,
and also, just to add, too, she is also basking in the arrogance of being basically untouchable in her district. So she's, that's just not even something that she's considering, as opposed to, like, for all the hand-wringing that we hear about, they can't go too far left because of the purple districts. I mean, Pelosi is doing that exact, like, by initially not backing this bill, that's the exact risk that she says that the left is causing for her with Democrats in precarious positions.
This is a perfect example of what we've been talking about, where they just do not seize the political moment at different times. I mean, you know, this is a pretty obvious slam dunk.
Coming off of Trump, you know, the 4 years of the just the abject, blatant corruption of this single man, the most hated man in America. I mean, sure, there are people who love him, but there are tons of people who loathe the very sight of him. And there are a lot of things you can attack him on, and I'm sure that, you know, he'll be attacked. But this was a global issue that you could have attacked.
Totally. Inside dealing.
Of Donald Trump. Inside dealing. The corruption, the self-dealing, spending money at his resorts, trying to have the G7 at his golf resort. You know, I mean, there was one thing after another. He personified this kind of just blatant, arrogant corruption in which it's just like, you know what, we just don't give a damn. Whatever, you know, we're going to do it. We're just going to do it. And I think that at this point, people are really, really sick of this manipulation by ultra rich people who were just basically, you know, Nancy Pelosi, frankly, is one of them, rich and powerful people. And it was a perfect moment to jump on that. And what, you know, you do January 6th, the threat to democracy, all this stuff, very important. But there is a bigger thing underneath this. There's that, well, it's as Emma said, it's the drain the swamp thing. You know, and Trump didn't make up that slogan either. He stole every slogan he ever had. Drain the swamp was I remember hearing it back in the 70s. You know, the concept of it has never been more salient. It's never been more salient. Maybe right after the 2008 financial crisis, which, of course, the Democrats blew that. Them too.
Let's pivot over to what's happening with the Republican Party at the moment. And that is, you know, the week started off with Mike Pence coming out and doing his best George W. Bush. That's when Pence is really feeling himself, he gets into George W. Bush, where he's like talking like this and
it gets the squint.
The squint. Yeah, we talked about the squint on the show. Yeah.
When it's an important speech, he angles himself in some way. Long pauses. Make things hit. You know, that's so
true. I hadn't realized he's doing a George W. Bush impression.
Oh, yeah.
That's exactly what it is. Oh, my God.
And he came out and said, you know, President, wrong.
Right.
Wrong. And then McConnell came out and said it, and they complained about, you know, Cheney getting censured by the RNC. What's going on with this? Like, what? And even Brian Kilmeade on his radio show said President Trump is wrong. It was as if, like, the clarion call had gone out now, and then then by the end of the week, it's all about the, you know, the Canadian anti-vaxxers who are driving trucks and blocking one third of the Canadian-U.S. trade. We should say only 10% of truckers in the entire country of Canada are unvaxxed, as opposed to like 40% in this country. But nevertheless, what do you make of this, Heather?
Well, I think this all has to do with the midterms. And I think that, you know, I mean, forgetting Pence and Trump, obviously that came out because Donald Trump had said, you know, Mike Pence should have overturned the election. And Pence apparently, you know, felt that that was, you know, he needed to say something about that, about overturning. But really, it's about control of the Republican Party. Pence is making a bet, as is Liz Cheney, that somehow or another, Trump is going to end up fading away. And there's going to be this residual, you know, group of heroes who stood up to him that are going to take over and, you know, become the Republican Party again. I have, you know, serious doubts that that's a reasonable assumption, but I think that's what they're doing. And in terms of the midterm, Mitch McConnell has a problem. First of all, the Democrats are defending far fewer states than the Republicans are this time.
In the Senate.
Yeah, Mitch McConnell. So in the Senate, and they're defending far fewer than the Republicans are. So McConnell needs to have races. He needs to have candidates and races that he can run in states that were going to require more than the hardcore Republican base to win. And it, you know, he needs Glenn Youngkin types, right? So he had been trying to recruit. He tried to recruit Sununu up in New Hampshire, and he tried to recruit Hogan in Maryland, both of whom could theoretically, they've won statewide races. They could theoretically win the Senate seat there. And, you know, in all everything else being equal, that would be the end of that, right? The Republicans would gain the Senate. Both of them declined, and largely because the mess in the party, Donald Trump, January 6th, the stolen election, the big lie, all that, they don't want any part of that. And they represent a, you know, some fraction of the Republican Party that does not want to hear any more about 2020. Mitch McConnell is very, very concerned about this, because in these states where they potentially have a pickup, like something like Pennsylvania, maybe Ohio, he's concerned that this Trumpism is actually going to either depress turnout of people who were thinking, it's all rigged, I don't need to vote, which is something they thought may have happened in Georgia last January during the runoff. And he's also concerned that the suburban moms, the independents particularly, are not going to turn out for super Trumpy candidates in those states. And so McConnell's very nervous about Donald Trump out there constantly pushing the big lie, and he wants him to shut up. McCarthy, on the other hand, has a different problem. He's got a bunch of nuts in his own caucus who are pressing him, that they want to press the big lie, that they're Trump people, and they have gerrymandered these races to the extent they were able, which was not quite as bad as we thought, but it's, you know, it's still substantial that these are more Trumpy districts than they even were before. So he has to deal with Dave, he's got to push the big liar, keep Trump at least, you know, involved in those races in order to win. So that's two, they are at cross, you know, purposes there. The RNC came in with the censure of Cheney and Kinzinger, and they put their thumb on the scale on the Trump side, the party did. And a lot of that is because they are closer to the party than the McConnell people are, or anybody in Washington is, and the party is the big lie party. And they know that, and they were under tremendous pressure to do it. Trump had David Bossie in there. You know, David Bossie, we've talked about him a million times. I mean, he is a hardcore character assassin from way back. And Trump sent him into the RNC and said, you know, you got to take care of Cheney and Kinzinger. And he shepherded this censure through the RNC, and they all went along with it. And the whole idea that they didn't hear that, they didn't know what they were saying when they said that it was legitimate political discourse. Of course they did. They heard it. They knew what they were saying. They got it out there, then they pulled it back, but everybody heard it and knew what they were saying. And that is Trump's, you know, he's pushing his people into the belief that January 6th was a legitimate protest, and that what they did was, you know, should be legal, and he promised pardons, et cetera, et cetera. So what you're seeing in the party, just to make a long story short, what you're seeing in a party is a real fissure. It's maybe one of the biggest ones I've ever seen. The person who surprised me the most of the ones you just mentioned, I mean, there were plenty who ran away from it, right? I mean, they're interviewing, you know, Josh Hawley, and he's going, well, that's their statement. It's not mine. And they have a right to say what they want, blah, blah, blah. Speaking of the RNC, Kilmeade is the one who surprised me. I did not expect that from him. And it, and you know, we haven't seen that appear yet in places like Laura Ingraham or Sean Hannity. I mean, it hasn't.
And it wasn't quite on Fox. I don't know if he actually said it on Fox as much as he said it on his radio show.
It's on his radio show. But it did indicate to me, and I mean, it was a pretty, you know, I mean, it was a pretty harsh statement. It was like, hey, you know, that's a liar. That's not true. You know, you yep. shut up or something. I mean, he was kind of hard on the guy who was just calling in and saying the normal Trump stuff. So I that surprised me. And it made me wonder whether or not Fox was kind of on, the, you know, or maybe there's some idea that they're going to have to switch gears. If that happens, that will be very interesting. Because that will be a step away from Trump in a way we haven't seen, and a step away from where the Republican base is. Now they're pushing this truck convoy, as you mentioned, which is, you know, unbelievable. I mean, these are the people who, you know, hate protests. They pass laws to run over protesters. So, you know, it's kind of surprising to see them out there, you know, basically, you know, carrying signs or whatever. But nonetheless, maybe they think they can distract away from the big lie and find some new way to sort of say what the base wants them to say, but I don't think Trump's going to let them. So we're seeing that there is a fissure here. It is big and it's widening, and the Democrats have got, well, I shouldn't say have got, they should figure out a way to exploit this for their own good. And I see, this is what I'm saying when I say, I see no evidence of that. You've got, I've never seen the report.
Oh, I would go even further. The last even reference that I saw, and it was a couple of days ago, that Joe Biden made to Mitch McConnell was like, he's my good friend. And I mean, honestly,
he said he was like, a man of his word.
I mean,
and a man of honor. Yeah. I mean, what?
A man of what word?
the only thing that the Democrats are doing, and I think they're doing it on purpose, is in pursuit of the January 6th, you know, committee, like pursuing January 6th keeps it in the forefront to some extent. It forces people to make choices like McConnell's having to make, you know, and the more they talk about January 6th and the more they tie in the Republican Party, like, my concern with the Democrats doing this is that they are actually doing it because they have a problem with Trump as opposed to Republicans. Like, again, the leadership of the Democratic Party takes any opportunity it can to say how important the good Republicans are. Like, that is completely just, I mean, I understand why you need to sort of maybe do some lip service to that idea a little bit, but I actually think that they operate like they believe it. And it is insane. It is insane for Joe Biden to be going out there and praising Mitch McConnell. Let's remind everybody, it wasn't just Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema who vote against the Build Back Better bill. It was also all the Republicans. And, you know, if you either think this is desperately needed by the American public, you either think that it's a desperate need to save democracy to pass voting rights bills, or you don't. And if it's a desperate need, in the midst of that, literally in the midst of that, you would think, I can't praise Mitch McConnell right now. I can't stomach it. I can't bring myself to it. I really genuinely believe there's an assault on democracy. We're watching what happened with Alabama and, you know, the Supreme Court disenfranchising black people. And I just can't bring myself to praise Mitch McConnell, who's responsible for those three justices who are sitting on there, who's stopping, you know, legislation to fix it. Like, well, you'd think that
Mitch McConnell was, you know, part of sparing Donald Trump, whom they supposedly think is the greatest threat to democracy the world has ever known. And Mitch McConnell and the rest of the Republicans saved him twice. He was impeached twice, and they couldn't bring themselves to actually, you know, convict him in an impeachment and, or at the very least, you know, preclude him from ever running again. Mitch McConnell said he'd vote for him again. So if he's the greatest threat to democracy, I don't think that Mitch McConnell can be said to be a man of honor. The Republican Party is part and parcel of the whole Donald Trump phenomenon. They are taking advantage of it. They are opportunistically welcoming it. You know, yes, they have an electoral problem with that. But they love the result, right?
Of course.
It's worked out great for them. Mitch got his judges. They got their tax cuts. What more do you want? I mean, sure, Donald Trump for another 4 years. Fine. You know, I mean, I don't think that they're concerned about that at all. They're concerned about losing their majority, but I don't think they care if Donald Trump is president.
I agree totally. I think this is a surgical issue for Mitch McConnell. Yeah. I mean, hopefully the stock trading ban thing really gets blown up, because if the Democrats know what they're doing, they will do that. And I actually think it could pass too, which I think as a policy matter, I think it would be a good thing. My favorite was that we had that quote. We were talking about Tommy Tuberville came the closest to it. I can't remember the quote, but it was basically like, you're not going to have any more millionaires in here. You're going to scare all the millionaires away from Congress. It's not fair.
Yeah. I mean, people aren't going to run if they can't take advantage of all their information. And what's the point? Why would you
drive all the millionaires out of Congress? And I should also, here is for maybe a couple of people to do things the wrong way. They're going to punish everybody else. God, unbelievable. I mean, this is fertile ground. I mean, if I'm Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, I mean, you know, once Pelosi comes around to like, oh, I guess we got to have this vote, even though it's going to inhibit the free market, I think is what she said. I mean, it's just sheer insanity. At that moment, honestly, like, where's the 25th Amendment for, you know, the Democratic caucus?
Well, we need that.
Or something that was not normal. Even it really wasn't normal for her to be that politically obtuse. I mean,
Don't you remember when she talked about we can't impeach Donald Trump because if we do, they won't be able to bring cases against him later? You know, she's just willing to go out and say the most outrageous, unsound things, frankly, when she gets it into her head that she doesn't want to do something.
Right.
And I mean, you know, she has a record of doing this. And one point about the Canadian I hesitate to say truckers because I think some of them are truckers, obviously, but it really is about anti-vax people who and I my sense of what has happened with this thing is that this was a grassroots phenomenon, not unlike. Well, I don't know. Even like the Tea Party, even its basics were terribly grassroots. It was the Tea Party was when it was a Ron Paul phenomena that got sort of like co-opted and then migrated over. But it was grassroots in the same way that we have anti-vaxxers in this country as well.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just grassroots, too. I mean, we covered it on the. Okay, go on, sir.
And then the right in this country starts pouring money into this.
Oh, while you're making that point.
And the value of them doing this, like, you know, people are like, why would this be valuable to the right wing in this country to do this? And it's not just the narrative. Because at one point, somebody was like, hey, wait a second. We have almost one third of the trade from Canada being blocked now. And we are out of the realm of, you know, I know Fox is making hay out of it because it's like some type of proletariat uprising. It's not.
And like they care.
Right. As if they care. But what it also is doing is, and we're going to see this in the coming weeks, it's going to increase the prices on cars. It is going to increase the prices on lumber. It is going to increase the prices on some agricultural products. I mean, we're going to see this in the data. I am quite convinced that the real big money is coming in and saying, like, figure out a way to screw up the trade. Because this stuff is not, it's not like if this ends tomorrow, we're going to feel the reverberations for weeks or months, at least in the data. If it ends in 3 or 4 weeks, this is going to last for 3 or 4 months, and it's going to create an ongoing ripple effect on prices in this country. And, you know, you could see there was a couple of folks who were digging into the shareholders meetings. You can look and see that in industries where there is higher concentration, you have greater inflation, and you have CEOs telling their shareholders, like, we've been able to capitalize on this environment and raise our prices, you know, well over the inflationary pressures that they have, to the extent that there are any. And these inflationary pressures, we should say, are all about the supply lines, all about logistics. And now we have one third of our trade is being halted with, I think, our number one trading partner. And so that's highly significant when we're talking about inflation. That's a story that doesn't feel like it's being reported. Like, it's just a coincidence that they decided to block. Like, wait a second. Why are they blocking trade with the U.S. if it's a domestic issue they have with Trudeau? Right? Like, this is, there's material value. It's not a coincidence that there's U.S. dollars flowing into that. And the implications are going to be felt here as much, if not more, than they are in Canada in terms of, like, inflationary pressures.
Well, and think of the political opportunity with that, too, for the Democrats.
Cool.
What you just said. And then there's the fact that they are, that this gambit on the part of whoever they may be manipulating it, and the people who were doing it, it's blue collar workers who are being affected. They're furloughing people in cars.
Yep.
Other truckers. There, other truckers are going, hey, man, you know, I got to get my stuff over here, and I've got to go around, and, you know, anyone who isn't participating, that it is the blue collar people who are being directly affected by this protest. And that's is an opportunity for the Democrats as well.
You know what? It would be nice if the Democrats, it's too bad, they don't have, like, some type of institutional ability to do some public hearings on who's funding this and who might be benefiting from it. It would be so awesome if the Democrats only had the ability to, like, hold public hearings on the question of the national security implications of our car industry, or whatever it is they want to, you know, create some pretenses. Like, who's funding?
I thought that's why they put AOC on oversight, right? They want to use her as an attack dog in that way. Then do so.
This should be happening yesterday.
They don't want the American public to understand how much dark money can do.
Maybe.
Well, that's probably part of it. I'm sure that's part of it. But yeah, I mean, this is, you know, there are that whole side of this equation, especially with this inflation. I have been really gobsmacked that I haven't seen the so-called left. I mean, I don't mean the left, but I mean the Democratic Party, I guess, attack this inflation for, you know, as price gouging.
It's unbelievable. It's insane. There's so much evidence of it. And there's, look, we have, and the idea, you know what it is? It's because there's the Larry Summers out there, that wing of the party, wants to make it as if the money that we gave to support people during the COVID relief is a function of, it's creating this inflation. And you're seeing it with this, like, attacks on MMT, because they do not want the dirty little secret out that you can spend money to support the American public and not create inflation. Because if you look what's happening in Europe, the differential in inflation in Europe, where they did not expend more money than normal because they already had these things in place, the differential in inflation from there to there can definitely be explained by a combination of supply, of logistic issues, and a price gouging that is taking place by CEOs. Yep. And concentration. I mean, it is. But, you know, of course you don't have a Democratic Party that's going to make hay out of this, because Nancy Pelosi is up there protecting the free market so they can trade stocks in the as lawmakers. Just effing nuts.
Yeah, crazy, crazy. And this is the one thing that they have that they could actually, I mean, you know, there's a populist feeling, I guess, in the country. It's been there for a while. I think since the financial crisis, we've been seeing this, maybe going all the way back to the 90s and Ross Perot and all that stuff, you know, trade deals and what have you. You know, this has been building for a long time. And the idea that the Democratic Party has not been able to co-opt that for themselves, being the party actually that gives a damn about the working class, and gives a damn about workers and, you know, and kids and all the rest of it, is just mind-boggling. And here we have...
It's not just that. I mean, here is where, you know, we have people who ride in and try and push this point all the time. There is a fear of harnessing that populist power in the Democratic Party in terms of, at least in terms of the big money that pushes this stuff. I mean, it is, I hate to use Air America as another example, but the Air America never got the funding from the big Democratic money people, because there was always this concern, I think, that was there, that was unstated, in addition to the management issues. But that was like, are we really giving money to go, like, populism is just not sexy for some people. You know, radio is not a sexy medium, but it is the most populist medium. It is the one that reaches 98% of the population in this country. And, you know, I think one of the reasons why, like, you know, John Edwards may have been a creep, but one of the reasons why he was, you know, there were everybody immediately went to Obama and Clinton in there is because Edwards is talking like a populist, and they did not want that. Heather Parton, people can find your work, obviously, at the Uber blog Hullabaloo and at Salon.com. It is always a pleasure.
Oh, thanks for having me. Have a great weekend, you guys.
Yeah, you Bye-bye. Too, Heather.
All right, folks. It is time. On Fridays, as you know, most Fridays, we have a second guest. The 45 minutes that we promise you for the free show, which has been all the years extended to an hour. Today ended up being an hour, 9 minutes, mm-hmm. their first guest, but yet we still have a second guest.
More and more content.
A famous, near famous, soon to be even more famous, I would imagine, editor and film connoisseur. Matthew Film Guy is with us, ladies and gentlemen, and you can tell because of this. How quaint it seems now to talk about a movie to stream, as if there's any other way to consume a movie these days. But when we first did this segment, that was like it was a newfound technology. And Matthew Film Guy, wait, what do you got going on there?
Hey, Sam. Oh, no. I just got my Biden crack pipe. So I was just enjoying it. In fact, I'm glad they finally learned their lesson. There was a long letter that said, thank you for, you know, being one of my voters. This came from Joe Biden, and they finally got that memo, I think, you were sending out.
It came out with the, they were sending the crack pipes with the tests that they were sending out.
Yeah, that's right. And, of course, I only smoke Save a Day out of it, just for the record.
Right, of course, of course. Matthew Film Guy, welcome. I have to say, you've trimmed your beard. I have grown a beard.
You have to say that? Okay, yeah, go on.
You have to, yeah.
Thank God I switched my glasses, or we would look almost identical today.
I know. I was going for the Sam Cedar in Pilot Season look.
Well, there you go. Mission accomplished. Matthew Film Guy, always a pleasure. How dramatically should we ignore the Oscar nominations? Like, how much should we forefront the fact that we're not going to talk about that?
Hmm. You know the music that comes in at Psycho when he picks up the knife?
Yeah.
That dramatically. It's coming after you.
That's as close as I can get.
I don't know.
I have to
admit. Can I selectively enjoy the Oscar nomination?
Well, I was going to suggest, is there some way to maybe wager on the Oscars? That might draw you in, Emma. I don't know. Is there an app?
I believe there is. I don't think legally, but I'm happy about one nomination. I'm happy that Kristen Stewart got nominated for Best Actress for Spencer. Nope.
Greatest actress who can't close her mouth is really how I feel about her. But listen, I was made to go see all the Twilight movies. Mary was a big fan. I showed up to some of them like at midnight screenings where it was like me and 500 screaming 14-year-old girls. So I've had a up close and personal view of her career trajectory. And I'm very proud that she's gone on to do these somewhat more serious films. Like, and I heard that Spencer was great.
Oh, yeah. You didn't see it. Do you like Personal Shopper? She's the real deal.
I have to say I've been observing from afar, but from what I can tell from this lofty perch, she's such a wonderful person. And both her and Robert Pattinson have just really blossomed. That whole thing didn't hold them back at all. But Mary saw Spencer and said it was great, said it was sort of like a horror-ish take. So, yeah. And also the director of the film I'm working on saw it and said it was great. So I'm rooting for that one, if to the extent I'm rooting for anything, but I literally have not seen any of the Oscar movies, just like usual. You know, again, I have a list of 1,500 movies on my Letterboxd of movies to see that I'd like to see first. So it's a little bit hard for me to get it up for that.
I have two things that are not going to come as like two confessions to make that are not going to come as a surprise to anybody.
Can I guess?
I'm here for myself. Yeah.
You can guess. You can guess.
You don't know who she is?
No. Not only do I not know who Kristen is and the other guy you just mentioned.
I remember her last name.
The two stars of Twilight.
Yes. And Twilight, I also am not familiar with. But
Myla never watched Twilight. Okay.
I came in today and I told Bradley, I said, we got Matthew Film Guide. He's like, good. He can tell us about the Oscar nominations. I didn't say anything to Bradley, but my first thought was like, oh, did those come out? I didn't know. So
when you said it in the intro, I was like, oh, did those come out?
So
even Trump knows.
Now I got to say, I feel better not knowing that A, they came out, or any idea of who the nominees were for anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can let go of the rope completely, isn't it? Free?
Doesn't know either. How the hell am I supposed to know?
Yeah, definitely not. I mean, is it ostensibly somewhat?
Put up a list and let's see who has seen the most or the least of these movies.
Okay, but
I googled it.
Donald Trump knows who Kristen Stewart was. Tweeted back during the Twilight movies, Robert Pattinson should not take back Kristen Stewart. She cheated on him like a dog and will do it again. Just watch. He can do much better. That's actually
what? Yeah, Trump reads like the Hollywood Press.
He's just tweeting about like a random scandal of a breakup in Hollywood.
He's a gossip columnist. He really
exactly.
That's his thing.
Oh, all right. I've seen one. Oh, I've seen two.
Which one?
What?
Yeah. Okay. So the nominees for Best Picture are Belfast. Had never heard of that, although I know who Kenneth Branagh is.
Nice.
He's been here for a long time.
You saw Dune, right?
Coda. I don't know anything about that. I saw Don't Look Up. And I saw Dune.
Ugh, King Richard, I gotta be honest, looks terrible.
Wait, The Power of the Dog. I saw that too, I think.
One I really want to see. Jane Campion, I like.
The Dog. What was that about?
It's like about a. It's a 1930s Benedict Cumberbatch, Kirsten Dunst.
I don't know who that
is. Is it in Australia?
Yeah, I did see that. Oh, yeah.
I think it's about like sexual repression.
Oh, yeah.
That
I did.
Saw.
That was good. I've seen three of the movies.
Nice. That's more than me.
You should run this segment, Sam. What should we be looking for at the Oscars this year?
I mean, look. I appreciate the message that Don't Look Up has. I was not as enamored with that film as some.
Just on a pure comedy level.
Yeah. I just, like, you know, I found
it was heavy-handed.
Well, no, the heavy-handedness I'm not necessarily against. I just, it felt to me like each of these big actors were in a different film.
Mm.
Like, every time I watch, like, the tone, like, the type of comedy was not consistent throughout.
Is he up for Best Director? Because that would seem to be a knock against that.
I don't.
Because I don't think Denis Villeneuve, I didn't even know
there was a Best Picture had been announced. They do it all at the same time? Is that basically it?
Yeah.
They should leak it out. Like, Sam, they should
want to. Sam, as you know, our fellow CIA handlers inform us of which films are going to be picked and which we should be boosting at the meeting every week. I saw you were there. And if you weren't paying attention, then that's just on you.
What?
The first rule of the CIA is...
People don't know this, but Sam recruited me into the CIA 20 years ago. This is how this works.
Power the Dog was good, and Dune was good.
I love Dune.
I started to watch Dune, but it was late at night, and I'm over 40, so I fell asleep.
I'll get back to it. I was a little bit disappointed. Free Guy was not there. I watched that with Saul. And,
did he like Free Guy?
We both enjoyed Free Guy.
Well, he's good. He's good.
Ryan Reynolds. I mean, come on. The guy, he's
a star.
Listen, anytime I watch a movie with Saul and it's not Jim Carrey, it's a win. That's the way I operate.
You are an anti-Jim Carrey.
Is he still into Jim Carrey?
He'll bring it up occasionally, but we went through the entire Jim Carrey oeuvre. And the only one that I was like even remotely okay was with the...
The Mask?
No. The
Man on the Moon?
No, the most recent one with the video game character.
Oh. I don't know what you're talking about.
The Razor or something like that.
Saul's clearly a huge fan of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, right?
He said like I don't like the way that Kaufman, who's the writer? Kaufman?
Kaufman was the writer.
I don't like the way that Charlie Kaufman deals with Jim Carrey's characters. So
you're thinking of Sonic
the Hedgehog.
I can't even remember that Jim Carrey like had done a movie before that in like 10 years. Like, I feel like that, I mean,
yeah, that's why it was like Jim Carrey was like not feeling his oats as much, and he was playing like a cartoon character, and he's good at playing a cartoon character.
What about Ron Howard's classic The Grinch?
Yeah, no, I can't.
I like that.
Stand Jim Carrey.
What do you think of number 23?
So, I think we watched that.
Where he's like the obsessive conspiracy theorist, right? Is that it?
Yeah, no, we didn't see that one.
What's the one with the Jennifer Aniston? Bruce Almighty? You don't like that?
The Cable Guy. Sam, you got to like The Cable Guy.
The Cable Guy was okay, not great.
Come on, Ben Stiller, you one of your friends.
Yeah, no, that was, I like The Cable Guy as a movie. It was,
as a movie. That's what I was talking about.
Jim Carrey movie. So I was like, oh, okay. I didn't dislike him in this.
What about the Truman Show? This is now a Jim Carrey segment.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's just like, it would be great if Jim Carrey wasn't doing it.
Wasn't chewing scenery in every second.
It's just sort of like, yes, we get it. You can make funny faces with your mouth.
I get it. See,
Just because you can't do that.
This is his like, you're jealous.
Exactly.
No, my point though is like, I think that if I grew up on so much Jim Carrey, right? I watched all those Ace Ventura movies, but I'm like 7 or 8, and I thought that he was so funny. If I was introduced to him as an adult, I'd hate him.
Oh, I was aware of him when he was on
In Living Color,
and I could not stand him on that. And that was
Fireman
when
Bill, you didn't like?
That was like, I was like, this is not. This is when I was a comedian and I was like doing comedy, and I'm like, this is not comedy.
Now we're getting to it. It was a rivalry at the time.
No, it was so outside of my realm. I'm like, it's fine, but it didn't even consider a comedy in any way that I would consider, like, I don't know. I never felt like I'm competing against Sesame Street.
Jordan.
Yeah, it was just sort of like, it's just this, I don't even know what that is. It's just a guy going on.
When Jim Parsons or whatever, or the guy from How I Met Your Mother.
You mean Jim Varney?
No, I'm thinking of those terrible sitcoms. The Oh, sorry. I know you like How I Met Your Mother. Sorry.
Sorry.
But also the one about the nerds, and it's very sexist.
Big Bang Theory.
And like they win awards for comedy, and they just say the lines like with emphasis on funny words, and there's a laugh track, and that's the end.
That show, I mean, Galecki, I am still a little friends with, and I watched it once, and I was like, honestly, if this whole thing was in French, I would get it more. Like, I don't understand. Like, I don't even understand why they chose certain places to put the laugh track in. Like, I couldn't figure out for the life of me. Like,
it's dystopian.
It's one of those shows where there's versions of it online where they've removed the laugh track, and it is a very surreal viewing experience.
Oh yeah,
it was surreal even with a laugh track, because I was like, I don't. It's this. Not that that was not a funny joke. It was like, I can't even figure out that it was a joke. And that
it's a show for pop culture nerds, which you are not.
That show could not have been more successful. It was massive.
Oh yeah, 2.5 Men, same deal. Number one show. Trash.
Massive. 2.5 Men, I could understand. It was just it was just unfunny.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just like the jokes were just like lackluster. Big Bang Theory.
You are such a cultural elitist.
I have no idea what was going on.
It's also very problematic, but that's a conversation for another day.
So
you're such a cultural elitist. But how the CIA wants it, so you know.
Exactly. That's what the CIA was like. We are going to bring it all down.
We just need to keep this puppetry going.
So we don't really have much to say about the Oscars. Just are they doing them in person?
Like we did.
Did they do them in person last year?
All I saw was that Pete Davidson was. They were considering him hosting.
I get confused between, like, I know the Grammys are like with free music.
They're terrible, yeah.
And the music. They still do them MTV awards. They still do those. Mm-hmm. What about the ESPYs?
They still do those.
I love the ESPYs because it's like, how else could you know which team is the best?
It's not even team awards, right? It's just like personal
is
stuff.
It? Yeah. I don't know. It's just always struck me as like, why would you need a sports? Like,
it's so stupid. I've never watched that in my life.
Don't they literally play games to determine who's the best?
And they have like awards for individual stuff in those sports too.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel bad about the awards they used to have about the models, top model awards, because that turned into just a popularity contest. And it really didn't capture the essence of what
you got snubbed.
It was just a popularity contest by the end. It wasn't really judging who was the best model. I just felt like, there's no
money really corrupts everything.
Matthew.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's get down to brass tacks. If we're not going to talk about the Oscars.
I will be right back.
And we're not going to talk about the.
I will be right back. All right, fine. You go.
I'm not going to talk about the models awards. What are you up to now? Like, last time we talked, had you gotten your job?
I was just in the early stages of editing this film, which we are now near the end of the process. I'm actually on hold. This is the first week I had not worked on it every single day because we're on hold for studio notes, and we're getting down to the end of it.
Whoa, studio notes. Now, who's the studio? Can you say?
Yeah, Vertical Features is one of the production companies that put up the money, so they're going to judge it. And then it goes on to the, I guess, higher up is Universal, I guess, has a deal with them. So then they have a bit of input, and then we're out. So, yeah.
So, let me ask you this. You do the cut, right? This is the first cut. That's obviously not the first cut. You have multiple cuts, but it's in a new category of first cut.
This is the first cut, the deepest.
This is the studio cut.
Well, actually, I did the editor cut, which I was sort of two-thirds of the way through. We had a kind of a compressed timeline. So in this case, I was about two-thirds through the editor's cut. Then the director came on, and we spent a number of weeks together making the director's cut. So he and I worked together right here and made that. And then that is what we submit to the producers, the two producers. They give us their notes. Then we incorporate those. Then we submit the producer-director cut to the studio, and that's what they're analyzing.
Okay. Now, do you guys, and now maybe you don't want to say this publicly, but do you...
Is anyone watching this? Really?
probably not. Do you put in like a little bit of fat in there for like a little bit of gimme, like, oh yeah, no, that scene, I guess, where we crossed the line. Yeah, that's a good idea. We should get that out or something like that. Like, what do you put in a little bit of bait in there so that like, or a little bit of chum so that, you know, the studio feels like you're listening to them when you cut stuff out?
No, every cut that we make is completely and 100% earned and desired by us.
Now, how come you're not blinking? Shouldn't you be blinking SOS during that?
We do exactly as we are told.
Do people do that?
No.
Not you, obviously, but have you heard of...
Nobody does that. That would be unethical.
Why is that unethical? Isn't it about...
You're supposed to just give your all 100% genuine effort, your creativity, your insight, your intelligence, your know-how, your skill, your craft, and then you let the producers ruin it. You don't do it.
All right. I mean,
fix it.
Fix it. Right. Okay.
I had always heard that Oliver Stone, that story you like to tell, that he writes a screenplay and he leaves a scene in that the producers then would say, oh, I don't want that. And so they feel like they're involved.
The scripts I used to write all the time.
Yeah. You got that from Oliver Stone. You didn't know it.
I didn't know.
I've heard that that is done, but you know, I cannot condone that kind of chicanery. No, not me.
Do you guys, when you're cutting, I actually saw an early cut of Pootie Tang back in the day.
Oh, wow. Don't brag.
I'm not. Well, I mean, I remember
it was actually during Bad Situationist, I think.
Yeah, I think it might have been. And it doesn't, obviously, it's not as
it's
fun.
It's a classic.
But and I remember walking out of there and going like, thinking, you know, there's only about five or six of us who watched it. It was the first time he had showed it to anybody. And I remember thinking like, they've got to cut it. They got to tighten. I mean, my advice was like, you got to tighten this up. It's too long. And, you know, Louis Style was to play stuff out quite a bit. And they sent it into the studio, and it was so untight that the studio basically took over the film. I mean, they took it from them.
That is the specter behind every film, including this one. So,
do you guys? That's what I was going to ask. Like, do you guys? How much does that weigh on you? Like, when you're looking at a cut, you're like, "This is a cut that I would like to keep," but I got three of those, and I know the studio is going to have a problem with these. So maybe we should just keep one or two. Like, how much does the specter of what you think the studio is going to do influence your cutting?
I, as the editor, feel like I'm kind of here
that's
to keep
not
it
your up. Job, but I'm saying the producer.
Right. Well, no, in the room that is discussed 100%. Of course it is, because you're meant to be. You know, it's a little bit of an. I won't say it's like a you know, adversarial system, but it is a little bit like the director is caught between, you know, what his original vision was and what the sort of commercial prospects are. The people above him, this director doesn't have final cut, which is rare for a director to have. And he's a first-time director, so I think it's part of the decision-making process there. So, yeah, that's absolutely. And, you know, in commercial filmmaking, which is what we're engaged in here, you do have to think about those things. And it's sort of – it's a guessing game a little bit, because one studio person could think this and another could think that. But you do have to try to put that headspace on at least a little bit. But I personally am always trying to be like the counterbalance – to, you know, the craft, the original vision, and try to keep that in mind. But obviously you acquiesce when it's time to.
What kind of budget is this film? How big of a film is it?
Let's just say under 100 million.
Fair enough. Okay.
Way under.
Don't want to tell.
It's a little bit bigger than what Black Bear was, but you know, okay. I wouldn't call it a big budget movie by any means. It's still a small movie.
Small size indie type of thing, or
yeah.
No?
Yeah, okay. It is. I mean, we have, you know, with having Emma Roberts and Michael Shannon, it immediately increases its commercial prospects with known names. So
I missed that. I missed. Sorry, the cast was. That's very exciting.
Yeah, yeah, it is very exciting. Of course, I didn't, just like Sam didn't know much about Kristen Stewart, I didn't know much about Emma Roberts.
He's like the repressed agent. He's a the creepy guy.
Oh.
He's amazing.
Mortal Empire. Yeah, he was definitely like, when I heard he was attached, I'm like, ting, you know. And he's like a small side-ish character, but his scenes are great.
Hmm? Emma Roberts is the niece of Julia Roberts, and she was in a show called Unfabulous. Thank you, Bradley.
She started as a teen Nickelodeon actress.
Yeah,
and she's actually, this Sam would get it better if you say she's the daughter of Eric Roberts.
Eric Roberts.
Oh, okay.
I dug my thumbs. Come on, we talk about that all the time.
I know Eric Roberts. I know Eric Roberts. Star 80 and
Greenwich Village.
Actually, knew somebody who rented his former house up in like Rhinecliffe.
Did they have family? Or did they just both succeed?
No, yeah, those are their folks, or like were producers or something like that. I mean, this is the thing, is that
I don't get into that, but yeah.
I met Julia Roberts when I was 6 or 7 years old. I was an extra in a movie.
What percentage would you say of actors
just blow past
who are successful have a parent who is an
95.
Actor? Right, honestly, like it's amazing. People don't realize this, but when you go into a room, and if you are Eric Roberts' daughter or Julia Roberts' niece, and you go into a room, and when you get there, the casting director is super excited. And so that's like worth like a 30% bump on your performance, at least. That's all that's, I mean, you want to talk about nepotism. I mean, you want to talk about getting a foot in the door. It's a perfect example. I think it's probably more extreme than it is in real life, but it is, you know.
Because it is in real life.
Well, I mean, it's nice to have a calling card, and that's a big one for them. But I mean,
my dad once had a meeting with Otto Preminger,
and look at you now.
Exactly. If not for that, where he was told I cannot hire you, where would I be today,
Matthew? Since people can go, and if they want to see the Oscar movies, they can go see them because they can. There's a list out there.
But I encourage you to see just any other classic movie. Well, first, but go on.
What I was leading up to, what, and maybe it's not on that list of 1,500 movies, do you recommend?
Well, not anymore because I've seen it.
This weekend.
Okay, I've got a couple good ones that, you know, I teach my class, which people can go and sign up still, even though it's still in progress. You can join us in the middle. We have a lot of great films still coming up. I think another 6 to see, where we watch them at home, and then we come in and we talk about them for 2 hours. And I'll give you a couple of the good ones that we've watched recently there, because to be honest, doing this movie, I haven't had time to see basically any other movies besides the one that I'm teaching.
I am satisfied with what you're teaching, because I have, as you know, multiple members of my family have participated in your class, and they extol it. I mean, it's so exciting.
It's nice to get extolled once in a while. Thank you, Sam.
Yeah. Extolled.
Yeah. No, I feel it.
All the E's.
All
the E's.
Yes.
All the E words, verbs.
Extolled and encouraged and excited. Yeah, yeah. Sam does a lot of E. I know that.
Jesus.
This week we watched, actually, this one is not one that we watched in class, but I would have brought it in. But I actually try not to give too many political movies. But for this audience, I think this is like a must-see movie. It's the first documentary, and it's sort of, you know, it's a documentary, but it's in this sort of art house tradition of the documentary, and it's called The Lovely Month of May, and it's Chris Marker, the French filmmaker who went on to make Sans Soleil and La Jetée, which is the inspiration for 12 Monkeys and some other stuff people have heard of. But The Lovely Month of May is like, I think, a quintessential early 60s political documentary. They were trying to recreate, I don't know if you're familiar at all with the origins of cinema verite, where it was the chronicles of a summer. It was Jean Rouch went out on the street and interviewed just French citizens on the street, and it was their attempt to make truth on film. And they basically came to the conclusion that no matter what you do, you can't capture truth because there's always a point of view and you edit things and so on. But it was their grand experiment. Lovely Month of May sort of does the same thing, I guess, like, I don't know, 20 something years later in the early 60s in France, going out on the street, interviewing people about their normal lives, the sort of, and it's so fascinating, all the issues. Again, on my little capsule review on Letterboxd said this, I don't know if it was encouraging and touching or like depressing and sort of devastating to realize that the almost exact same dynamics that they're discussing in the 60s in France are still with us today. Things like gentrification, things like government assistance, things like even there's a scene with what you might call today tech bros talking about innovation and automation and the 30-hour work week. It's like pretty incredible. But it's intercut in a very sort of, I want to say sort of artistic way, but that's a little general, with intercuts of cat videos and things that are still with us. Chris Marker loved cats. But it's basically interviews on the street and capturing a very charged political moment because Algiers was still going on. There was a fallout from a coup that actually was attempted when the French government wanted to pull out of Algiers.
What year is this?
1962.
Okay, so we're still 6 years off from the 68 hours.
Yes, and it's so amazing how you can see the seeds of that being planted because there are street protests, there are funerals in the streets that are like massive for these people who are killed in political violence. And then there's just like bourgeois women going like, oh, women shouldn't be involved in politics. It's like this very interesting cultural snapshot of the time. I highly recommend that. But then one of the films that we actually did watch, which is, I say, sort of borderline because it has political implications, is Il Posto by Ermanno Olmi. It's one of the original Italian neorealist films, also early 60s, but very much more a story of a young man. It's almost a coming of age story, but it's shot in that kind of, neorealistic way with non-actors and sort of street scenes. And it's basically about a kid growing from high school to getting his first job in this sort of like almost socialist system in Italy post-war, where they're, you know, sort of having to take all these tests and things like that. And it's just his sort of a few days in his life, but it is shot with such exquisite sensitivity. The actor's face is so beautiful and it makes so much of the film mean what it means. Not very didactic, but you pick up a lot of, what it means to be a human being, you know? All these big questions of interiority, what we share with others, where we're individuals and where we're a collective, things that really in film really turn me on and make me excited to be alive. So Il Posto is the other film that I think people should definitely go out and see. I think it's on the Criterion Channel and some other places.
Well, there it is, folks. The lovely month of May, Il Posto. Matthew, film guy, so glad that executives are overseeing your cut of this film. What is the film again?
It's called Abandoned, at least currently. You know, titles change, but
Abandoned,
directed by Spencer Squire, starring Emma Roberts and John Gallagher Jr. and also Michael Shannon.
Their deliberation is our gain.
I had one other thing I just want to shoehorn. I forgot to mention this, but I heard you mention, and this was actually the last time I was interested in the Oscars. I heard you mention you went to high school with the guy who wrote The Joker. Is that true?
Yeah.
I went to high school with the guy who edited The Joker.
Did you?
Wow.
I did. Well, and that actually means that was the last time I cared about the Oscars because he was nominated for that movie, which I didn't love it, but, you know, respected the editing for sure.
You know the sister of the guy who wrote the Joker?
I do?
Worked with her. Yes, on a bad situation.
Did I like her?
Yeah.
I liked everybody, so yeah.
Do a little research.
Okay, I will Google that right now.
Matthew, are you aware that obviously you're a very busy guy, you could be called to set at any time, but that you are now on the bill for the live show from Brooklyn, New York?
On
March 26th at 2 p.m. It's
yes,
a Saturday.
Wow.
Matthew, film guy, will be there. There's a little bit of hints as to what part of what his offerings are going to be. But we will talk more about that then. Matthew, film guy, so glad you're on the bill. People can get their tickets right now at majoritylive.com. Check it out.
Don't miss it.
Stupid. Yeah. Matthew, always a pleasure. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, Sam. Talk to you soon.
That's a good reminder, folks. I will tell you right now, I knew this would happen. You could still get tickets for Boston. We're probably three quarters of full. Some we had a few cancellations because we shifted it, but we have less tickets than we did before the cancellation. That's happening in May. You still have a little time on that one. May 15th at 2 p.m. Mm-hmm. That is a Sunday in Boston. Check it out. We have Larry Murphy, John H. John Benjamin, Natalie Scherr. And we have some other special guests, one of whom I just need to just confirm again by email. We'll lock our musical guest in. We have another special guest who I probably will never say the name until that day and will not disappoint. But you can also go to the Brooklyn show. In the Brooklyn show, you got to act fast because I told you it would sell out quick. We announced it, what, like a week ago?
Yeah.
Okay. There's less than a third of the tickets left. So you better get on it. Brooklyn, March 26th, at the Bell House. There's only like 300 maybe seats available, maybe a little bit more. You got to get your ticket. I don't want anybody crying at me afterwards. Well, I didn't know. You got to get your ticket. And at the very least, Matthew Film Guy will be there. And, of course, all of us will be there. And there's going to be more. We're going to announce it as we get closer. Nice. So check it out. This breaking news, I guess we should just do a Freebie Friday because we only got about 45 okay. minutes left here. U.S. believes that Putin has decided to invade Ukraine and communicated those plans to the Russian military. Three officials tell Nick Schifrin, two administration officials say they expect the invasion to begin next week, echoing what Secretary of State Blinken has said. Now, have they provided evidence for this? I mean, we will probably not see like the communique that would have issued this. They believe it. Are they right? Are they wrong? We don't know. We will find out. But I think they're making a big effort to get Americans out of Ukraine. And I think they're preparing the world. And I think it's, you know, clear the Biden administration doesn't want to have U.S. personnel involved in this whatsoever. And, you know, this this has been coming for a while. Like I heard on the if Putin wanted to embarrass the U.S., he could say, like, look, I never went in. And on some level, I don't know. I don't know what their theory is, and maybe that's helpful. But I certainly would like that to be the case.
Yeah.
I would set up whatever system, whatever context the U.S. can do to minimize the chances of a Russian invasion, not because I... You know, just out of like just a desire to have not people die in a war.
I just hope it's like that viral video of those guys giving each other middle fingers in their faces, right? And it looks like they're about to fight, but they just keep flipping each other off more aggressively. That's my hope for what this is. Just exaggerated chest puffing with increased stakes every time, but no one takes the bait.
Like a West Side Story type of thing, where they just, you know, maybe they could do a dance-off.
People die in West Side Story at the end.
Oh, that's true. Spoiler alert.
Sorry. You had West Side Story on the brain because it's nominated for an Oscar.
That's what I just saw that, yeah. Mm-hmm. I've been meaning to watch that, too.
Me too. I want to see it because it's like they have actual Latino people in it as opposed to Natalie Wood.
I saw it in theaters, actually. It's very good. Yeah. I really enjoyed it.
Ansel Elgort's in it. Sucks.
Yeah, he's okay. He's actually pretty good in it, you know, regardless of weirdness about him.
Yeah, I've
lost my... Oh, here it is. Sound sheet. All right, let's go to the IMs, shall we? Tell me. Oh, my God. This is a long one. What? Sam, you worthless... Here we go. C dongle. I just wonder why Emma and the crew doesn't finally tell you straight to your... into your... Jeez, foreskin quilt of a face. The fact that it's obvious to all but you that they hate your guts with the heat of 1,000 suns. They hate you more than Silicon Valley startups hate vowels. Sorry you have to learn this fact this way. I figured the realization would have now just sort of slowly trickled into your increasingly feeble brain. Kind of like the humiliating, ineffectual trickle you experience at the urinal these days.
Jesus
and to that point,
Christ.
I can only imagine the harrowing choices a geriatric like you has to make when that extra cup of orange juice in the morning means 15 minutes of Chinese water torture as you stand, pants around your ankles, behind a concrete pillar in the subway, howling from a demonically unrelenting, penile stinging, heretofore mercifully known not to man nor beast itself, grotesquely harmonized with your feral shrieks of lament of a life all but passed by, yet all but unlived.
So your Sam's being in public.
Your dignity invisible for all to see. I've said it before and I'll say it again there, but for the effing grace of God. What happened to the part about, like, we love the show? Yeah, I was waiting for that turn.
Nah,
that was too long. If you're going to do that whole thing, I was... it's got you could have done that over the course of two or three days. Oliver Wendell Holmes slice, the gazpacho, gets all the attention. But what about the General Heinz ketchup Guardian? And of course, Admiral Karl Donuts, commander of the German Kriegsmarine. Brooklyn Sue, Marjorie Taylor Greene, truly bouillabaisse. Custodial artist, how many fireplaces did Trump walk past to flush documents? Or is he out of toilet paper for his golden throne? Last one, no wonder he complained about low toilet pressure. They're clogged with confidential toilet paper.
All right.
You didn't love that.
I don't like thinking about Trump pooping.
Taking a poop.
Wiping.
Yeah.
I
put on both of my pants with two legs at one leg at a time.
He probably has a golden toilet.
Oh, we know he does.
Oh, we've seen pictures of it.
Yeah, there's pictures. At least in his New York City apartment. Yeah. Right?
Brett from North.
He ever comes back here.
Brett from North. North GA, North Georgia. Hey, Sam and crew, just became a member after listening for years. Oh, well, thank you for that. Wanted to ask you about John Ossoff. Previously, you said you weren't a fan of him. I wanted to see if your opinion has changed at all with his stocks bill. I know the bill isn't perfect, and he's no Bernie or Merkley, but for a senator from Georgia, I think he's pretty damn good.
No, I think you just said that.
I
agree.
I would agree with the way that you said that. I mean, if it is important to have those two votes, Warnock and Ossoff from Georgia. Certainly, at the very least, for judicial nominees. I mean, and I can say that even for Sinema and Manchin. But Ossoff, I have to say, you know, based upon my expectations so far, good. Now, limited opportunity to be problematic in this context. But so far, good. So far, good. You know, relative to expectations that I had. Kid tested, Politburo approved. Emma, are you betting the over and under of sacks given up by the Bengals? I feel like that'd be a safe over.
My book doesn't have doesn't have that, like, defense. It's just DraftKings sucks. I don't want to open another account in another sports book because that... You know, that's just got to limit myself.
The lifestyle choice.
Right. So I don't have that. I don't have that, but I would have 100% bet the over. I mean, this front is legit. Aaron Donald, Leonard Floyd, Von Miller, who is, like, the perfect veteran to have in this situation. So, I mean, I'm worried about Joe Burrow.
I feel like I just come to work to find out all the things I have no idea that's going on.
Yeah.
Vincent Van Gogh. Richie said 72, not 32. Yes, I'm old and lame. And it was beer, now that I think about it. I just had a tiny glass of beer. How many? 72.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Glass Siegel. If you are someone whose podcast you listen to has a gambling problem, call 1-800-5... Singular phenomenon.
Sam is playing this up. He's playing it up. This does not reflect my reality.
Can't wait for Feldman's bid on the Supreme Court. Don't get me wrong. I think it's great that Biden's looking at black women, and I just want him to pick the right guy for the job. Turk's twerk. When I watched Jim Carrey's Fireman Bill when I was a kid, it was my favorite thing ever. I just rewatched it recently as an adult and was like, what the F? Teacher Dan, I'm sure the Democratic Party, Biden especially, in their hearts, want to make it right by poorer, browner populations and places torn apart by American nation-building energy interventionism. They just don't know how. You know, I think it's a mistake. I keep saying this to you, but I've never said what's in their heart. I don't. As far as I'm concerned, all of their hearts are shriveled black, you know, black like prunes. That's not the point. It's what their agenda is. And that is shaped by, I don't know if that's shaped by their hearts or what, but another long hauler. When can I sue the Trump and Biden families for losing my stepmom and getting long COVID? Do I need to wait 20 years? Ugh.
Jesus, I'm so sorry.
Barnacle Boy. Hey, guys, I was hoping maybe you looked more into your commentary on the Dave Chappelle comments. Your long-lost son, Vaush, took a deeper dive on it last night. It seemed that Dave's concern about the property development is that it wasn't necessarily his private interest, but that the development prioritized building expensive housing rather than the planned affordable housing units. He was That's concerned with the ability for younger people to buy housing and for a school being built, as the village he lives in, the average household is age 49 years old. It seemed like a lot of bad takes yesterday, and it was hoping to get Matt and Emma's opinion on it. Not saying as a defender of Dave's bad comedy, just wondering why the vitriol has to be so rough sometimes when it was a lot more context than him having a lot of money or sway.
Well, I don't know that I necessarily buy that. Based on the reporting that I saw, they got rid of the affordable housing element and just did more single-family housing. Now, if Dave Chappelle's saying we just want the single-family housing for the young people, like, he can say that, but you don't necessarily have to buy that. I think it's suspicious. But I welcome more, because there wasn't a whole lot of reporting on it yesterday, and that's why I said during the show, like, if more stuff comes out. But I will also say, somebody saying to a board, my way or my investment goes, is something I don't think deserves the benefit of the doubt. And if he can explain it better lately, like, he can. But I don't think, like, that's something that people have to go jump over backwards to.
The threat in and of itself is reprehensible.
And what happened was, like, they got rid of everything that wasn't single-family housing. So, like, that is political. Single-family housing versus, like, multiplexes and duplexes, that's a political choice.
Can I just interject really quickly just to say, guys, Dave Chappelle is not a god. Like, he can do bad things. He's capable of doing bad things. Like, he's a guy. Like, he's a rich guy. He's a rich, ornery guy. So, like, he doesn't always require the benefit of the doubt. He said, he walked up to the microphone, said what he said, and then left. There's no other context. He spoke for 40 seconds. That's what he said. The development passed without the affordable housing in it.
He's such a huge part of so many people's childhoods that it's hard for people to let go of that stuff. So I understand that. I mean, that's really what it is. That's a huge part of it.
Also, if you're a property owner and you're pulling your weight like that, you have to make it clear that it's actually for the people and not for the property owning class, which is the suspicion. And I think, like, that's a valid suspicion to have of a clip like that.
It's always snowing in Ottawa. I can't wait for the report 3 years down the line when we find out the string of foreign aid services taking the $3.5 billion subcontract jobs to each other to the point of no money or aid actually makes it to Afghan people. Indeed. TYT, in talking about the congressional stock trading quote, had a quote from Tuberville on the stock ban. I think it's ridiculous. They may well start sending robots up here.
I will be on TYT tonight. I need to say that. I'm sorry for just before I forget. If anyone wants to tune in, I'll be on tonight.
I think it would really cut back on the amount of people that would want to come up and serve. Well, that's sort of like that other quote. He's just literally saying, like, what kind of nation are we going to be if we don't allow millionaires to come up in here and trade their stuff? Damn. Censoring. Look, is this not censorship of House members who can't express? I mean, we've already established deployment of money is speech. We know that the right has used things like the First Amendment to attack regulation that isn't necessarily about speech per se. Are we going to hear cries of censorship? Mm. Why?
Money is speech.
Well, are we going to just say that, like, you can't? Are we going to allow congressional people to buy coffee? We're going to allow them to buy coffee at Starbucks? I mean, we're not going to allow them to buy stocks Are we going to allow them to buy coffee? What about betting? What about betting? What about, I mean, are members, are lawmakers not allowed to buy what they want to buy? God, this censorship, it's a slippery slope.
Speaking of that, you bring up the betting thing, which is interesting because, like, it's interesting that sports leagues have more stringent laws for their own, or bylaws for their own players, than we have for members of Congress, because, you know, some Evander Kane in the NHL was allegedly betting on games. You cannot do that. There's a bunch of rules and fines that would be in place if you were found sports betting on your own games, because it compromises the integrity of the game. And yet, in Congress...
I will say two things. That is a great point.
Mm-hmm.
And I said betting, not betting. I think you got something on your mind right what? Now.
You said what?
Betting, like sheets.
Oh.
You heard betting. But your betting point is a great point.
I thought you were, like, smiling at me because the point I was making was so incredible.
No.
You were just waiting to pounce.
No. It was a great point. And I
and
also
you were gleeful
say,
about it.
And
yeah,
I was like, wow,
go.
Yeah, you heard betting.
Emma's in Uncut Gems territory right now.
God damn it, I'm not. Someone's going to call and she's in denial, bro.
Yeah, it's like... Like, how long after the Super Bowl are you on to, like, wait, hockey? What do we got? What do I get? Where?
I already bet on hockey.
So, is it too late for me to bet on the medal tallies at the Olympics?
I got good odds there's another crash at the Tour de France this year.
What about when Shaun White flies out of China? Like, what's the line on that? What's the over under? Is he going to take a direct flight?
We got the flight logs. Like, statistically, we show he likes morning flights more than.
All right.
Afternoon.
What should we?
Let's do this teacher. That's
is that four, three?
Six.
Oh, six. Oh, yeah, okay. Yes. This is a Texas State House candidate, Shelley Luther. She is speaking at a county Republican event in Georgia. In Georgia?
Yeah, it's close by.
It's okay. County, Georgia. Okay, Georgia in Georgia, Texas. What's it?
She's trying to gain like exposure. She's just at an event. They invited her to an event in another state.
In Georgia.
No, Fannin County is in Texas. It's in Texas.
Oh, really? They're all the websites in Georgia. Sorry, guys.
Maybe there's a Fannin in Georgia.
Mm.
That's weird. Anyways, she's a Texas State House candidate. And there's one in Georgia too, so there's some confusion as to exactly where she is, but the point is she's running for the Republican State House and could be either state, frankly, based upon their politics. And this is not an outlier. I want to make this clear. I've run into this attitude for a long time on the right, not necessarily about specifically about. Well, play the clip.
I don't know any other counties that are more Bible Belt conservative than this district. And it's the Overton window. They have AOC in Congress on the left. And what we have done is become comfortable with what is okay in our society. I am not comfortable with the transgenders, the kids that they brought in my classroom when they said that this kid is transgendering into a different sex, that I couldn't have kids laugh at them like I couldn't have like other kids got in trouble for having transgender kids in my class. That's why I vote for school choice. And my opponent is completely against school choice. Thank you.
Wow. Did people follow what she was saying here?
Pro-bullying.
I mean,
I think she.
What was, do you think she what was holding back with that gap?
Oh,
that
yeah.
7-minute gap.
Go back.
when she realizes that she may have stepped in it by saying kids should be allowed to ridicule trans kids at school.
I think she was also wondering if she should say something more. Go back here. I mean, the sentiment as she expressed it in and of itself is just barbaric.
Right.
It is barbaric.
I mean, just imagine what lessons this woman's teaching her children.
There's other parts that are fascinating about it. Play the clip again, Bradley.
Awesome. Yeah. I don't know any other counties that are more Bible Belt conservative than this district. And it's the Overton window. They have AOC in Congress on the left. And what we have done is become comfortable with what is okay in our society. I am not comfortable with the transgenders, the kids that they brought in my classroom, when they said that this kid is transgendering into a different sex, that I couldn't have kids laugh at them, like I couldn't have... like other kids got in trouble for having transgender kids in my class. That's why I vote for school choice.
Pause it. Other kids got in trouble for having transgender kids in my class. So she went from, like, I can't have kids laugh at the transgender kids. Should I say this? Let me, how do I rephrase this? Other kids got in trouble because I had transgender kids in my class. In other words, I was forced to punish kids who may have beat up this kid, or, I mean, we already had laugh at. So, like, what is it that she wasn't saying?
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, she thought better of it. The irony, of course, is that she starts the whole thing off by saying, we need to push the Overton window. I'm going to be the person who helps society really, really continue to stigmatize, to hate transgender people. That's my, you send me to the state house, you send me to Congress, I will be the person who is going to be the ballast on the side of hating, ridiculing, maybe physically beating up transgender kids. And I will tell you this right now, this is not new. This is not unique. I've talked about this, you know, the calls I used to make to the American Family Association. I had almost the exact same call where a guy was like, but it was about gay. It was about kids who were gay. You know, now they won't let you, bully the, I mean, I think it literally said bully the gay kids. And that's a problem. A little bit of bullying is good for kids. It keeps them in line. And that's what she's advocating. And I'm telling you, like, this is not an outlier. This is an example of what is here and what is coming.
The Overton window shift that she talks about there is that she is promising, if you vote for me, as you say, I will be the person in Congress. I will make it possible for society to be more acceptable of bullying and of hurting and excommunicating, essentially. People, nut jobs like her, see that if we allow for the ridicule of trans kids, then we can essentially convert them back to the good kinds of kids that we appreciate, that we want to foster in society.
And we talked to Chris about this yesterday, but like in Texas, they like their public schools there. This is an attack on that. And she even delivered that there. That's why we're going for school choice. She didn't say much there, but she said the school choice thing. Also, there is a Fannin County in Georgia and Texas. James Walker Fannin Jr. was an American military figure and slave trader in the Texas Army and leader during the Texas Revolution. He was a transatlantic slave trader. After that, was even made illegal. So that's who that was named after.
All right.
School choice has always been about, two things. It's evolved. School choice was developed because you do not want your school to be integrated with black kids. That's where that first was developed. It has now been adopted by the Christian right in this country. You go back, you can look, you can find Betsy DeVos and her husband talking about the concept. This is well before she was made Secretary of Education by Donald Trump. No problem with public schools or public education. Only a problem with public schools. So the idea is perfectly okay with taxing people for public education. And then we take the money and we allow for choice. And the numbers do not lie, folks. Charters, all well and good from their perspective, but this is a way to fund Christian parochial schools. Period. End of story. It's what Betsy DeVos wants. It's certainly what this woman wants. It is a way, and the way that you get those folks riled up is all the transgenders that are going to be in the classroom preventing your kids from laughing and beating them up. That's why we need school choice. Segregate out the transgenders. Yeah, I'm sure they also talk about the gays.
Mm-hmm.
And there probably is a bonus. Is like, we're going to have, you know, it's okay to have a couple of black people in there. But
I mean, right now we covered this a little bit, but in Florida, the Florida Education Committee has moved in the direction of allowing for that Don't Say Gay bill to get passed down there, which essentially bars Florida educators from talking about sexual orientation or gender identity whatsoever in classes. So they are
like treat a kid who may have two same-sex parents as, you know, that as if that is something that doesn't need to be kept taboo.
Right. As if it's like a dirty word that you're not allowed to say in school, essentially. It's a retread of don't ask, don't tell, but we're going to apply it to education policy.
Oh, it's worse than that. I think it's even worse than that, frankly. But yes, it is. We're going backwards without a doubt. And you know, people have been. Who was it that wrote a book about this? Was it Michael Signorelli wrote a book about this? About, you know, the it's not over, this fight. It is not over. All right, what else should we do here?
Let me see. Lindsey Graham, maybe the Lindsey Graham thing, but that was.
Yeah, we could do that. I would also love to do the Jesse Waters stuff, which is a little less serious. We could start with the Lindsey Graham.
Oh, is this number 20?
Yeah, but we could do the Lindsey Graham one also.
Oh, 20. I didn't even get that far down the sheet.
All right, let's do Graham, and then we'll do Waters.
Okay.
This is, which number is Graham again?
5.
Lindsey Graham, there's a, you know, Lindsey Graham is getting, he's walking a little bit of a fine line here, right? Because he may end up voting for the Biden Supreme Court pick. I mean, that's what makes me nervous about these clips here, where, you know, when Lindsey Graham feels like puts his finger up in the air and needs to throw a fit.
Yeah.
He's always worried about getting primaried in South Carolina. He feels like maybe he's not fully cloaked, as it were, and needs to get some protection.
He's like a tough guy.
Maybe he's going to be voting. He thinks he might be voting for the Supreme Court nominee. You know, again, Childs, Clyburn's candidate, South Carolina justice. We will see who Biden's going to pick, but here is Lindsey Graham. You always, whenever you see Lindsey Graham throw one of these fits, he's doing so out of some type of fear that he has. And then you got to worry about what it is that he feels exposed. He used to be, he was just afraid because he wasn't enough of a Trumpster at first. Remember?
Yeah.
Trump like gave out his phone number and mocked him. And so he had to spend the next 4 years, well, you got to wonder what this is about. But here he is at the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing with a person from the ACLU.
And this is also, we should say, a hearing on the civilians that were murdered by the United States in the wake of the Biden administration's Afghanistan withdrawal. We did those drone strikes that were ostensibly in retaliation for the attacks as we were evacuating Afghanistan, and we killed 20 civilians, is my recollection. So they're having hearings on this, and Lindsey Graham wants to look as bloodthirsty as possible.
And also, he knows he's going to be taking a vote soon on, and it could be, he could be voting to actually confirm a black woman to the Supreme Court. So
let's offset.
Let's offset here.
Senator Leahy will also join. Senator Graham, you're next.
So I have a slightly different take. General Jumper, is America at war?
Pause it for a second. I'm sorry.
To the American.
This guy, General John Jumper, who is being questioned here, and he's, like, I guess, the more right-wing witness for this story, he did not disclose this in his testimony per responsible statecraft, but he was the chairman and CEO of a drone manufacturer called Leidos from 2012 to 2014 and continued to serve on its board of directors until 2018. So he might have an opinion on drone strikes.
American servicemen, sir, we've been at war for a long time.
Well, is the American people at war? If so, who with? Who are we at war with?
Sir, we're fighting an enemy out there who's determined to kill us.
Who are they? Are
these terrorist organizations that we...
Al-Qaeda? Is that an enemy of the ISIS, American people?
ISIS and Al-Qaeda continue to be...
Ms. Shamsi, do you agree that, or do you believe, that if Al-Qaeda and ISIS could strike them... attack the American homeland, they would.
She's from the ACLU.
Excuse me. Senator Graham, I think what's important is that...
No, what's important is you answer the question first and give an explanation. It's a simple question. Do you believe if Al-Qaeda and ISIS had the ability, they have the desire, I think, they had the ability, they would strike America today or tomorrow if they could?
Senator Graham, the reason that I'm having a hard time answering that with a yes or no answer is because...
That's all I need to know, because nobody in the world should have a hard time answering that yes or no. If you can't answer that yes or no, you have no idea what you're talking about. You're living in a dream world, because I can tell you right now, ma'am, if they could kill us all, they would. The only reason 3,000 Americans died on 9/11 is they couldn't find a way to kill 3 million of us. If they could find a way to kill 3 million of us, they would do it. So, Mr. Sales, what's the...
Oh, do we not have the part where he asked him about if drone strikes work? It's okay, if, I mean, but he gets a little more animated.
Do we have it?
Yeah, you can do it.
Yeah, do it.
Is it less, more, the same?
I think it's substantial, Senator. It is not what it was before 9/11, in part because we have used force to degrade their networks and to destroy their sources of fundraising and to harden our borders. Their capability to strike the homeland may be less than it was 20 years ago, but the intention to strike the homeland, to strike us around the world, is still very present.
Would you say their ability to plan an attack in Afghanistan against the American people has gone up since our withdrawal?
Senator, I'm sorry to agree with you that it has gone up. We don't have the intelligence collection capabilities to know what our enemies are doing in Afghanistan, nor do we have strike assets that can take action when necessary.
General Jumper, you're an Air Force guy. I'm a lawyer. You're a pilot. has the drone program prevented pilots from being put at risk?
That's not the main point, sir, but the answer is yes. I don't think that's the main point of the drone program.
Well, the drone program, has it been an effective tool in terms of killing terrorists?
Very effective, sir.
Has it killed civilians?
It has, sir.
Name any weapon system that hasn't killed civilians.
No.
Name any war that civilians haven't been killed in operations. Count me in transparency. You're right about that. I want to know more about the drone program.
That's really...
I can't believe it.
Pause it. I'd like to know how many Americans have been killed in this drone war. How many American civilians have been killed in this drone war? It happens with everybody, he says. Happens with every weapon. Therefore, it's okay. Their ability to strike greatly diminished, but their desire... We haven't gotten rid of the desire. to strike the United States. You know what happens when you kill hundreds, thousands of civilians over the course of time?
Starve.
Do you think desire starts to peter out? Like, oh, yeah.
No,
my dad was killed. My child was killed. My aunt was killed. My brother was killed. That has really diminished my desire to strike the United States.
I don't even know what I was mad about before.
He does mention before, he doesn't mention any of the U.S. civilians that were killed in our war, our drone war. He does mention 3,000 civilians that were killed on 9/11, 21 years ago, or 20, now it's 2022, but yeah, so 20 years ago at this point. That is a continued justification for killing as many civilians and continuing this drone war and this war in general into infinity.
It is literally into infinity, because there's always going to be people out there who want to do us harm. There's always, and we're always going to want to do harm to other people. That's the way that works.
As evidenced by the civilian casualties that they're having a hearing about.
Well, by evidence of the fact that he's sitting there trumpeting, drone warfare, period. And that the state of human beings wanting to do harm to other people is never going to end. We, look, when you want to cut back on funding for unemployment, you're doing harm to people, right? On some level, you're not trying to kill them necessarily. When you are, what are we doing in terms of keeping people from white collar crime? There's always going to be an intention to embezzle funds,
to steal your wages,
to steal your wage. Like, it's just an absurd. It's a war on intent. It's a war on thoughts.
And the distinction between civilians and combatants, people who are participating in the war, in this nebulous war on terror, that it's largely meaningless. Anybody can be a terrorist if they decide to justify it publicly. The people that are civilians and are categorized as such are probably so egregiously civilians, like, I don't know, children. How, 8 children died in that strike? Is that what he's talking about there? Babies? Yeah. Then you can't really classify them as militants or terrorists. It's just they are also using these outdated distinctions in order to justify tribalism, bloodthirstiness, and empire.
And we should be clear, obviously, the Biden administration has been better than the Trump administration in terms of drones, in terms of killing civilians. That's no doubt. But they still have killed civilians, still take a certain amount of pride in it. Announced gleefully the other day, they killed this ISIS guy. Actually, he ended up killing himself, didn't he? With a bunch of other civilians.
Which we have no idea if that's actually true.
We don't even know if that's true at this point. We just know that there was a tremendous amount of carnage. There it is. Back on the IMs. Horny for war. Sam, I recently saw a clip video of you saying wars don't affect most people one iota. What do you mean? War impacts economy, price of goods, mental health of a generation, redirection of funds, and whatnot. Really want to know what you more about that. Well, I don't think I said war generally. I said the Iraq war. And I can tell you, we still have people there. I was talking about the American public was completely shielded from the impact of the Iraq war. I think aside from obviously people who've sent family over there, military personnel and their family and whatnot. But the average person, walking American citizen, walking around in New York or in Lincoln, Nebraska, or Billings, Montana, or, you know, I don't know, Chico, California. No, and virtually no concept that we were at war, that we were killing. Some days hundreds of people, some days maybe just tens, maybe over the course of all those years, thousands upon thousands. The war impacting our economy? I mean, show me evidence that the war in Iraq impacted our economy. We went from a huge boom that was built up over, that was a real estate bubble, to a massive financial crash, to the Fed just juicing banks. And, I mean, I don't think that war, you know, I suppose you could argue that the extra expenditure for the military-industrial complex helped in some, you know, regional areas, I guess. But, I mean, we're spending money on those weapons anyways. They've seemed to figure out a way of doing that. The mental health of a generation. Show me the mental health implications for your average American about the hundreds of thousands of people we killed in Iraq. I'm sorry. The redirection of funds? But we don't need those funds. Those funds were not going to be expended on anything in this country if they weren't going to that.
It certainly affected the mental health of the soldiers.
Of course,
who had to
of course.
Murder
but we're
people,
talking about the general citizenry. I challenge anybody.
And there are very tangible ways that you can point to how the war completely decimated Iraq. We completely destroyed their clean water infrastructure. We murdered hundreds of thousands of people. We deformed hundreds of thousands of people.
2 million internal refugees, 4 million, 2 million external refugees. We did this on a daily basis. I was on national radio. Talking about it every day. And I would walk around New York City. I visited Lincoln, Nebraska. Nobody was conscious of it. It was not a big deal. It didn't impact people on a daily basis whatsoever. That was the nature of it. That was also part of the agenda on some level. And that's why, again, why Bush didn't want to have even, you know, it wouldn't allow images of dead U.S. servicemen and women coming home. They wouldn't show the coffins.
Where the IDW never like talks about case studies of censorship like that.
Yeah, by 2000, even four, like, you know, I'm sure you could go back and look at like the network news coverage of the war, and it would. I imagine that they would mention it, but it would get like maybe 15, 20 seconds, probably on average a night. X number of people died in Kandahar today, or there was an explosion. A Shiite, bomb went off in a mosque. No, I'm sorry. I mean, I don't know what that clipped video was necessarily. I don't know if that was a recent or an old one, but I challenge anybody to show me, and I'm not saying this to justify war. I'm saying that we in this country have the ability to wage war and kill hundreds of thousands of people, and the body politic is barely moved by it. And if you want to show me refutation of that, I would love to look at it. And I say this, obviously, it's a huge lament. I was screaming about it on the radio for years. And I can tell you, I mean, it's a very different era in terms of politics, but I mean, people would look at you like you were insane. And other people would. You know, there's a reason why we, even in 2004, why we had to leave those buildings with bats at night. The only thing that would get people excited or aroused or even engaged in the notion that we were at war is that if they wanted to keep you from talking about how wrong it was that we were in it. That was the only time you could get people who were actively You know, they're burning books. They're burning the Dixie Chick albums. It's the only time you get people like sort of like even aware that we were at war, when people were talking about why we shouldn't be at war. Amanda Huguenots. It's crazy that you'll get in trouble for saying Sebade, but Cowan Crowder gets away with his racist hoggery. Yeah, well, it's not so much you get in trouble. It's just that you'll get demonetized. I don't know how they work it. The way you say Sebade is actually the letters Sebe and De in French.
Oh,
I thought you knew.
No,
bien sûr.
It was on purpose.
Zut alors.
Bon chance.
Bon chance.
Bon chance. Talk on your front of your mouth.
Enchanté.
Enchanté, mademoiselle. Voulez-vous boucher avec moi? Sorry.
I think Robert Pattinson will make a good Batman because he's such an unrelenting weirdo. Really?
Yeah, I'm pumped about that.
I don't know who that guy is.
We just talked about him, but that's okay.
Oh, wait. Is he the guy, the weird guy from the FBI agent? From?
No. No, that's Michael Shannon.
Oh, all right. Fierce Deity. Wow, two guests with a theme song in one day. Emma loves to bet on football while enjoying a vegan meal and hating other women. D's Bolts. Bring back Bill O'Reilly, say baby, but replace the second B with a dubbed in D, and then you have a new way to say say bay day. Listening at Work. Alex Press's Jack in the Piece from yesterday covers a podcast released by REI explaining why unionization in the company would hinder the company's ability to address social justice within the stores. Really disappointing to see a company I've supported for years using their supposed progressive ideals to justify union busting.
Yeah.
The podcast REI CEO Eric Arts states that REI is pro-union, but unionization at REI would hurt their ability to address the issues raised by unionization efforts. Disgusting. Can you imagine, like, I mean, I suspect what it has to do with is, like, we don't want to lose bargaining power.
Yep.
But to actually sort of deploy out there that it's going to hurt their ability to address issues, you know.
They have to say that we actually care about your concerns and we want to meet them just through, like, our management techniques. And this is, like, there's this Harvard, it's same thing with the contractors in California, but, like, Harvard had this, I think it was Harvard, had this white paper out that's like, you know, we need to do something for these contractor workers, but the unionization of yesteryear was really problematic in who it left out of. So we need to create a new, like, sub-union type of classification that, it's all like, it's done in the language of social justice, but it's trying to screw workers.
Yeah. I love the fact that Harold Ford hangs out with these guys now. I just love it. Jesse Waters, Greg Gutfeld, Harold Ford Jr. walk into a bar. And, oh wait, no, I'm sorry. They have a TV show.
Ah.
It's called Fox 5. And apparently there was a video going around of a fight in a school.
Okay.
I don't know about how unique that is.
World star kid, Fox.
I mean, honestly, like, when I was a kid, we had fights. I remember seeing some very nasty fights. Ambulances having to come up in high school. It's just... In fact, there's even this movie called West Side Story that was based upon all the fights that happened back in the 50s with kids. I mean...
Very similar to your childhood?
A lot of, like, dancing, fighting type moves.
Yeah, knives.
Okay. There were weapons in some of these fights.
Mm-hmm.
And like people would wear sharp things to cut other people.
Oh yeah. Like, keys in there.
Well, no, you put the keys in there, but people would actually like, they would wear
the 80s would be spikes and stuff.
Yeah. Spikes.
Just by the hair, spiky hair.
Anyways, here's Jesse Waters and Greg Gutfeld on Harold Ford Jr., and this is interesting.
This will continue.
Yeah, I was going to blame Psaki, too. That was my idea. But no, the teacher doesn't want to get involved because the trial lawyers will sue her pants off. And this happened to me one time.
It did?
Yep. I was sitting behind a kid in junior high in Spanish class, and I was just whipping rubber bands at the back of his neck, like, whap, whack.
This is the part about you say we didn't get a chance to see what was happening.
And then so like the back of his neck just got beet red, just really tore his flesh up. And then after the last one, maybe the seventh one, he turns around and he just went, woo. And I covered up and I blocked all the shots. But I mean, he definitely got a few shots off.
Did you get in trouble?
Yes. And I threatened that we were going to fight after class. And then immediately we got suspended, in school suspension. And then we patched things up and we ended up stealing beer from the special office where they used to entertain for fundraisers and then stashed it outside.
Should I interrupt
woods.
Here? Yes. Is the statute of limitations passed?
No. I think I've told my father about this. And then went and got the beer later before a dead
but
show.
These kinds this, of this, things.
That
are
did not
gross.
Help this story whatsoever.
No, but I'm saying people need to get involved. Someone stood up and took the kid off of me when he started raining blows down. You can't have someone just launch off on some girl like that and not intervene.
Or maybe you shouldn't have been hitting the guy in the back of the neck.
Well, I deserved it. Yes. I totally deserved it. And maybe that's what that girl did.
Hmm. Police officers, law enforcement in schools, should we have more of that, Greg? Or
in some schools, absolutely. But you know what this...
So this is the point, though. If, I mean, bizarre, but if there were cops in Jesse Waters' high school... Maybe he would have had something on his record. I mean, he talks about how he stole beer. That's a criminal act. We need some tough-on-crime policies to go after the Jesse Waterses of the world. I mean, honestly, crime in preppy high schools is out of control. Lock them up.
Also, Jesse Waters likes to get his ass kicked, it seems like.
The school he went to, I believe, was a private school, as you can tell, I think, from his story, because in most public schools, you don't have, like, a reception area with beer. My understanding is, and double-check on this, William, that it was the William Penn Charter School, but I don't know that it was actually a public charter school. I believe it was a private charter school. I think one of those Quaker-style schools. Cost, I don't know, a couple of $1,000s. Who knows how much it cost then? But it is amazing. Like, it's like they just turned them out there. Jesse Waters and his buddy Tucker Carlson, they just get pumped out of private school, both probably ushered into Trinity, where their parents probably...
Jesse Waters didn't learn the pacifist lessons
apparently
from
not.
His Quaker...
I don't know,
Quaker school.
But your point is like, I mean, the stealing the beer, and if Jesse Waters, as a, well, this is 2022, but obviously an expensive private school, Jesse Waters, let's just imagine he does the same thing in a school, and he is a black teenager. And he is, he gets an actual record that sticks with it. His father doesn't just find out now.
Yeah.
Parents find out in the moment because he is, is now in a spiraling system where he is going to be tagged with a record that is going to implicate the rest of his school career. Maybe it gets him into further trouble. That gets into further trouble. He's just like, and doesn't even consider that moment could have fundamentally changed his life the way that it does for a lot of the people that he rails on all the time.
And remember, like, it was just in October when that story out of Louisiana with the dads on duty came around, and it's like people on the right were promoting it as if, because I think they like to say, like, hey, let's get it, it's all these PMC teachers that are brainwashing your kids, let's get the dads in. But like that, their mind goes straight to cops still. It's not that like fathers need more time off from, like, say, the need to earn a living and more time spent with their families. It's let's get more cops in there to arrest people.
Right. I mean, what if Harold Ford's idea to have more cops in the schools, what if Jesse Waters had been subjected to that suggestion? The likelihood of him sitting there, well, I mean, Jesse Waters you know, I think the resources that he had. But let's again
say he didn't have
Jesse,
private
Jesse Water yeah. didn't have those. Wasn't at a private school. Wasn't from a wealthy family. But had the same inclination to do that with a rubber band.
Because cops are there. Because he might be a, yeah. kid, a punk kid.
There's
right?
evidence this kid's neck is just, like you said, raw with this rubber band.
Yeah, I mean, his entire trajectory of his life is different. Now, to be fair, he probably wouldn't be where he was if he didn't have a wealthy family and hadn't gone to a private school anyways. But any opportunities that this guy had were a function of the fact that he didn't have to have any accountability for the greater part of his life. And no still concept. Doesn't. Yeah. No concept of that whatsoever. No concept of it whatsoever. None. What do you want to play? That clip of Greenwald or Dore?
Aye, aye, aye.
You don't want to? I just thought that was funny just because I didn't realize.
We can do it.
I didn't realize how much license I had. I just was feeling so bad about the fact that I'm a corporate colleague with John Brennan.
No longer.
And several teenagers.
Oh, well, I guess you are a
I mean, I think I am technically still a contributor. Do you want to do that? Let's.
That's
we just
fine.
Should we just play this without comment? Let's do this. Let's just play this without comment. Give him an opportunity. We're just going to put up the tweet afterwards. Okay, Bradley, do you have my tweet? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, without comment.
Last point is I was watching some Tucker Carlson videos in preparation for this.
Uh-huh.
And I just found one that I thought was interesting that I wanted to bring up here, which is where he wanted to charge Black Lives Matter protesters for domestic terrorism.
Right. I didn't see that segment. I don't agree with charging domestic activists, U.S. citizens, with domestic terrorism charges.
All right. I just thought that was interesting, especially given his comments about January 6th and whole narrative there.
I mean, it sounds like a lot of your critiques are for Tucker Carlson. I'm a separate person from him. I appear on his show once every 2 weeks or so. I don't, not married to him. I don't, I'm not his agent or his spokesman. I'm a journalist who does my own work separate and apart from him. I appear on his program sometimes, like I appear on many programs sometimes. And I think that you have this like Twitter conception that I'm like tied at the hip to him and that I'm therefore should have like a obligation to have a running commentary on everything he says. And it's just an obligation I reject.
A Twitter conception.
It's not my role to like permanently be commenting on a cable host and every segment that he does and every comment that he makes.
No, but like you frequently do comment on things he says, but to be supportive of him on Twitter.
Yeah, because I think that he plays an important role in the media ecosystem, like when he is the only cable host agitating for a pardon for Julian Assange and Edward Snowden, or is the only one out there agitating against U.S. interference in Cuba. So when he is playing an important role that I think is positive and should be highlighted, I highlight it. But I don't think that means that it creates like a countervailing obligation for me to comment on everything he says that I don't agree with. I have no idea what segment you're referring to. I didn't hear that segment. I don't, like I said, I don't watch that program unless I'm on it. So I don't understand the critique. I get the critique you have for him.
Pause it. Coincidentally, he said they think a kid just went. All right. Like I say, no comment on this. I don't think we need any comment. We just put up that tweet that is just like, what, 3 days old or something like that, that somebody had sent me. Just for the record, I have never, ever seen John Brennan in the flesh or been on television with him. Bill Kristol, to the extent that I have spent years calling him craptastic and mocking him, and I think we've incidentally done videos on every single person that Glenn had mentioned in this, including Joy Reid. I think there was one time I appeared with Bill Kristol on a segment. I didn't know that he was on there. We did not talk, and it was like one of those like jokey segments. And I told the MSNBC people, never, ever, ever again bring me on to do anything except argue with him. And he wants to know why, and I wasn't, I don't know what deplatforming means in this context.
So he says, do you think John Brennan, Bill Kristol, and Joy Reid should be fired or at least deplatformed by Comcast NBC for their chronic lying the way you and Chris were trying to pressure Spotify to do to Joe Rogan?
Well, aside from the fact that it was a lie, I wasn't saying that Spotify should or do, you know, I said that they need to take responsibility for it. And I, without a doubt, and in fact, have done videos about this while I was on their streaming platform. But John Brennan or whatever, whoever came up during that time anyways, but certainly videos on all these people that, yes, they should be held accountable for them. And if that means fire them or deplatform them, absolutely. But he says these are your corporate colleagues. It's almost like I have some type of responsibility for these people who I have never, ever applauded anything they've ever said, ever, ever, ever in any context. But if it doesn't matter, like, I mean, if John Brennan said, like, we should have, we should extend the child tax credit, I would not be praising John Brennan for that. I think Bill Kristol has probably said, you should do something positive once. I don't care. I don't care. In fact, if I remember correctly, Glenn Greenwald was a frequent guest on Rachel Maddow's show. Why isn't he still? Is it like what? Like it doesn't matter what if the negative things they say. I mean, come on, you just like.
Well, it's like it's not that you don't constantly criticize Tucker. So you've never done it. Like you won't do it. You're avoidant professionally of doing that, and but everybody sees it now. Even the teenager, that's the thing we have to point out, right?
This kid Nicholas. Good job, you know, bravely coming on this guy's show. This is not Nicholas's podcast. That is Glenn's show. So the person he's having on to debate him has braces. I'm just pointing that out.
Well, no. To be fair, Glenn put out a call for people to challenge him and critique him.
Yes.
And if you watch the first 6-minute intro to this, he shits all over the kid, basically, for being, you know, not unique, and he discourages his audience from putting it out there. But I think he knew that, like, he had to publish it because he had recorded it, and maybe the kid had recorded it.
Step up. I mean, you know, he is appealing to a right-wing audience now, Glenn, so it only makes sense for him to play the hits of what they appreciate. And Steven Crowder has had a ton of success in this area debating kids, because that is from Steven. Right. I mean, he's learning from the pros on the right wing. You've got to only debate children at this point in your grift.
It helps when you look like reasonably close in age then, because it starts looking a lot worse when there's a big gap in that and you're still getting rolled.
Yeah, that was pretty impressive.
Good job, Nicholas.
I guess we'll have to save the... that video. Let's save the one by Jose.
Oh, yeah.
I watched that. That was great. But people should check out Jose. He's a YouTuber. We may have plugged it already. He did another video essay on Jimmy Dore's vaccine misinformation. Very good in the vein of Sean's, which was also, of course, excellent.
All right. Let's do some IMs, and then we'll get out of here. Majority Report wardrobe coordinator, I'd suggest creating a daily over-under on how many times Sam's accidentally reads a dirty IM, but then Emma would become the Pete Rose of political commentators. Slap from Montreal. Slap cough from Montreal. As the trucker protests in parentheses continue, now parentheses, quotations, Quebec nurses have filed a human rights complaint to the UN for forced labor and absurd amount of nurses, still not receiving a promised boost in wages after months of pleading to our corporatist government. Quebec is rolling back measures and learning to live with the virus, citing concerns for people's mental health, bolstered by the province media obsession with the cure being worse than the disease narrative. I feel like we are at the most absurd points of the pandemic. Yes. Well, hopefully that is we're at the end. But that is the idea of how insane we've gone and what the function of the virus is are two separate things. We can only hope that there's somewhat coincidentally in sync. Ken Cancer. Every day the show starts with that wonderful John Benjamin fellow and then gets sidetracked into politics or whatever. Let's get more of that burgers with Bob guy, please. Thank you. And where's the soft collared shirt today? It's here. It's soft collared. What do you think of the comedy in the community or Rick and Morty aside from the toxic online communities?
Everyone who I like really thinks it's really funny, and I think it's fine.
It's too hectic for me. I have a hard time, enjoying any cartoon that, frankly, doesn't have John Benjamin voicing a character. Like, Archer and Bob's Burgers are basically the ones I like.
I have never enjoyed any animated show ever. I love doing it, but I've never watched it. I've only seen one, I think, episode. Mama Pelosi, Sam, the stock trading ban can be a big populist move, but to be honest, anyone saying Pelosi has reversed her stance or supported the move is hogwash. She just said members can bring it up for a bill and will be considered. How is it a pro-ban stance or anything around that? Why is the excitement around this news? She is not listen, the Speaker of the House can basically, as a parliamentary move, and certainly with her power, she could have prevented it. She could have prevented it. I mean, this is not a compliment on Nancy Pelosi. She doesn't want this thing to go forward, without a doubt. She's just stopped fighting, or at least stopped fighting it through parliamentary procedure. Steve Vig, if you wanted to compensate 9/11s, take it out of Saudi aid. Yes. That was Emma's point. Crab saltine cracker. Can't wait for the right to call the supply chain impact of the trucker blockades Bidenflation. What about the Arizona bill that will legally mandate teachers out of their LGBTQ students to out their LGBTQ students to their parents? If the teacher Jesus fails to report Christ. Them, they will. Yeah. We got to start.
These people are disgusting.
Fat Jay. Since Matthew Film Guy is in today, it's a good time to let folks know his movie Black Bear is now available in Hulu.
This is a very enjoyable movie for last year.
Colorado Baby Boomer. Sam, don't get too high and mighty about Senators for Georgia. New York and California could do a hell of a lot better than they do. Oh, you don't need to tell
me. Were we getting high and mighty?
That's the thing, is Ossoff is judged as a Georgia senator.
Yes, exactly. You're saying he's good for
Georgia. The differential between where Ossoff is delivered and what we expect out of Georgia is far better than what it is, in my estimation, as to what we expect out of Schumer from New York or Dianne Feinstein from California. React Lord, genuinely curious, what's the point of reacting to videos within hours without full story unfolds? Reacting to right-wing nut jobs is one thing, but stories like Chappelle need time to unravel, and breaking news like
Jesus
reactions
Christ,
don't
guys,
add any
relax.
Value.
I don't think that, I think like the property owners are like as big a problem as right-wing nut jobs, frankly.
I mean, you can appreciate his comedy still. It's all good.
I think there's certainly, I honestly thought that, the first three sentence lines of what you wrote was a legitimate, I don't know if it was critique for us necessarily, but a legitimate question. I do think that we wait on some stories until there's full reporting, and that's a responsible thing to do. The last thing I'm worried about is that Chappelle story.
And we commented on it with citations from local papers on this. This is not, I wouldn't have commented on it if it was just the video.
Yeah, I think it's an open question. If Chappelle has more explanation and actually it checks out. But what I'm hearing so far as explanation, it seems like the usual rigmarole that you get from NIMBY types when they don't want certain types of housing that's going to lower their property values. So if that's not the case, then we can find that out. But I think it's fine to put it forward as a problem.
Here's what his spokesperson said. Here you go. Dave Chappelle didn't kill affordable housing. Concerned residents and a responding village council killed a half-baked plan which never actually offered affordable housing, which is not what the people on the ground seem to be saying. Neither Dave nor his neighbors are against affordable housing. However, they are against the poorly vetted, cookie-cutter, sprawl-style development deal, which has little regard for the community, culture, and infrastructure of the village, which we are seeing. They are still going through with a lot of the development, but they took out the affordable housing piece. This is mincing words in order to cover your ass.
You know what? Like, let's just try a different analogy. Seattle has a half-baked plan to increase corporate taxes. And Microsoft steps in and says, if you do this, we will flex our muscle, our economic might, and break the city. But wait a second. You haven't really gone into the details of the tax plan. All right, let's not even call it a tax plan. Whatever it is. That was the part that I found offensive.
Exactly. That's the there's the content thing, which people are quibbling with and trying to say, like, actually, it's something good. But there's also the form of a guy saying, my investment, I get my way, or my investment goes.
I mean, if this was a situation where it's like, okay, I'm doing a, I'm investing a lot of money in drive-in movie theaters, just as an example. Okay, I'm investing in four of them in this town. Let's just pretend that that was a good business move. And the city council is like, we're going to outlaw movies after 5 p.m. outdoors. This is what we're debating today. And I come up and I go, hey, look, I'm not going to invest in these outdoor movie theaters because I need it to be dark out before people can watch my movie. And if you say you can't have movies out at 5 p.m., I'm going to pull my investment out. That to me seems legit and okay. But if you come in and say, if this city or town or whatever it is decides to do X, it's going to change something that has really nothing to do with my investment. But I'm going to leverage my money over what this town does, I got a problem with that. I don't care if it's Dave Chappelle or if it's Bill Gates or whomever. It doesn't matter to me.
And this is a process, too. If that statement put out by Chappelle's spokesperson that they actually have a commitment, they would like to see low-income housing in the community is truthful, which I don't believe it is. But if it is, we'll see in the fruit. Like, we'll see if you actually do this.
I just don't like the idea that a somebody who owns maybe a disparate amount of the resources in a small town comes in and does this. It's just, yeah, it's petty corruption. Now, of course, if it wasn't Chappelle, we wouldn't know about it because it happens every day.
Yep. Exactly.
But it is a good illustration of a dynamic that exists both in Seattle and in small towns and probably on our federal government on some level, just in a much more quiet way.
We don't get so pissed off defending for additional context when like NFL owners threaten or just leave cities because taxpayers won't fund their stadiums. So yeah, we just don't get, we're not like, oh, Stan Kroenke needs more context to move to LA. We don't need that because we don't like Stan Kroenke. So
yes, again, okay, this is all just about someone,
all right,
having an emotional stake in errors, being in your childhood memories.
Is this me? The right has always been pro-bullying. The bully is a tool of social order who calls the divergent from the herd. I noticed this when I was in fourth grade, that I was viciously bullied by administrators and teachers just stood by watching. I can only imagine how much worse it is for transsexuals. Matt from PVD, please have the Birds Aren't Real kid on for a casual Friday episode. He's doing God's work. Oh, yes, yes. Let's do that. Will you reach out to him? I love that dude. Nightmare Blunt Rotation. To other IMers, can we not associate Vouch with MR? I like being here without thinking douchebag debate bros lurk amongst us. Well, I mean, I've been called a douchebag debate bro. Brah, brah. Hey, man, I was at the Battle of Chico, and it was truly horrifying. Visors flipped upside down, cargo shorts soiled, flip-flops abandoned on the sidewalk, empty bush cans as far as the eye could see. Never forget. All right, two more. Groenwald. I feel sadder and angrier watching Greenwald today than Dor or any other grifter. He was an actual hero for a short time, one of the greatest of that time. To see him like this is a testament to humans can change for the worse without any self-awareness or self-check. I certainly can appreciate that feeling. Certainly had it at one point. 30. Somebody is, I think, just sort of spamming us. Marilyn Manchin. Hi, Sam, crew. Big fan from way back. Today is the last day as manager at a community mental health clinic in Texas. I'm transferring to a provider role and joining the unionization effort.
Nice.
My employer won't recognize the group as a collective bargaining group because they say Texas law prohibits public sector unions, so I'm not sure what our options are. Any suggestions? I would call a bunch of unions and see if they have any ideas as to who that you could talk. I really don't know. In Texas, I would usually say the Department of Labor, but not in Texas. I would maybe see if there's any unions who are in comparable facilities in blue states and call them and try and get their advice. All right, the final IM of the week. Congressional baseball fan. Hi, I'm on the betting of subject of balls and strikes. It's not degenerate. It's a pastime. I only bet 20 peanuts at each time each bet. Over the course of a game, there's an average of 150 pitches thrown by a team. So that works out to only 3,000 peanuts a game, which at an average of 30 peanuts per ounce works out to be 3,200 calories. So not a whole lot.
All right.
Matt, Bradley, Emma, great job this week. See you folks on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the Nets are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive.